Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
City and it rocks. It's on Motor City Riffs.
Detroit. Our number 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the show. Joining me, of course, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter.
We really have to begin with rock and roll news, don't we?
Well,
because
it's always good.
One of our assistant producers, Al Slayer, is at Ozfest,
yes.
Which is here. A free concert. Ozzy has it all free, except you got to pay $20 to park.
Hey, but it's the sentiment that counts, right? And you know what? It's Sharon Osbourne who does all of that business stuff. Ozzy has nothing to do with it. He just goes, all right, Sharon, whatever you say.
And $11 for a hot dog or something like that as well. And the other piece of rock and roll news here on WRN. The Night Call show. Jalene Jordan will be rocking all night long.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to be on.
You're going to be a DJ.
Yes. Right. I'm going to play a DJ from about 2 a.m. to 5:30
a.m.
Yeah.
All right. But we got a lot of ground to cover. This is insane. Look at how many stories I've got. I mean, is this out of control?
Quite a stack it is. Well, because the world is out of control, Peter.
Exactly. How come George W. Bush is still in office? I don't understand that.
You know, it's a pretty basic question, but really, how come?
Well, could be this. This is from Breitbart, which is a right-wing kind of news service, sort of like Yahoo or something like that. But most U.S. adults in the dark about world politics, it says.
Really? When I read that headline, I thought, no.
Well, that's part of our answer as to why George W. Bush is still in office. Two-thirds of U.S. adults admit to being in the dark about political issues outside the United States. Only a third are well-versed in U.S. politics. But, you know, it's like, what do they say about I guess you can't say those words anyway, but about your butt, everyone has their, opinions are everybody's got one.
Mm-hmm.
So here's one of the reasons. You tell us at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, why George W. Bush is still in office after this comes out. This is from August 22nd, so this has been, and this is what, the 26th still. So this came out Monday or Tuesday. CIA lays out errors it made before September 11th. Oh, gee. Let me just read it to you, just the first two paragraphs. Report released Tuesday by the Central Intelligence Agency includes, that's sort of a misnomer in many ways, isn't it? An oxymoron, Central Intelligence Agency, includes new details of the agency's missteps before the September 11th attacks, outlining what the report says were failures to grasp the role being played by terror mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and to assess fully the threats by streaming into the... this is very, very important. I didn't say that right. It's got to be said... very correctly. The CIA, the report says, were failures to grasp the role being played by the terror mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and to assess fully the threats streaming into the CIA in the summer of 2001. So it was all there, friends. All the information was coming into the so-called intelligence agencies, and nothing happened. Except it did on September 11th. The 19-page report prepared by the agency's inspector general. So this is like a self-critique. This is self-criticism. This isn't somebody outside the agency. But they say that 50 to 60 CIA officers knew of intelligence reports in 2000 that two of the September 11th hijackers may have been in the United States, but none of those Maybe I should let you read these.
Officers.
Thank you. None of those officers thought to notify the Federal Bureau of Investigation about the potential domestic threat, the report says, evidence of what it calls a systemic failure.
And what were they so busy working on that they couldn't put any focus on this? 50 to 60. It's not, you think maybe 10, but when you hear that number, it's even more astounding.
Now, the director of the CIA, George Tenet, he received the Medal of Freedom from George W. Bush for all the wonderful work he had done. Well, now the Inspector General of the CIA recommends that several top agency officials, including former Director Tenet, be held accountable for their failure to put in place a strategy to dismantle al-Qaeda in the years before September 11, 2001.
There you go, for starters, and then take that medal away.
Yeah, take the medal away. Indeed.
The Medal of Death.
Now, some people are going to say, well, wait a minute. OGW was only in office for about 10 and a half months. So, and if you want to lay stuff on Clinton, I'm not even going to argue with it. But what I'm talking about is that the ultimately, like Harry Truman used to say, the buck stops here. But it never does. It never lands on George W. Bush's desk. And I haven't said this in a while. I used to say it all the time. If Al Gore hadn't have been cheated out of the presidency and properly seated in the Oval Office, and September of 11th would have happened during his administration, mm-hmm. he would have been drummed out of office. He would have been impeached by the Republicans. And you know what I would have said? Well, he really screwed up big time and deserves it. Just like George W. Bush should have been driven from office for this catastrophic intelligence failure that first led to the slaughter of 3,000 Americans at home and now has led to the slaughter of 4,000 Americans in Iraq and 25,000 wounded, all of because of the missteps of these evil, incompetent...
Yeah, it was a very bloody week once again over in Iraq. And but Bush still says that things are going to be just peachy.
Free Iraq within reach. But get this. I just saw this as I was coming in. Bin Laden wanted U.S. to invade Iraq. Hey, this is by Tony Jones. It's at abcnews.net. And as coalition troops continue to die in Iraqi soil and the U.S. government's military spending on the war bleeds into billions of dollars, a new book says that not only could this have been avoided, but it was all predictable as long as you had read the Al-Qaeda manual. Abdul Bari Atwan is one of the only Western journalists to have interviewed Osama bin Laden, spending 3 days with him 11 years ago. And here was an interview with ABC TV's Late Line. Tony Jones says, when you met bin Laden, he told you his long-term plan was, quote, to bring the Americans into a fight on Muslim soil, close quote.
Wanted to have further eruption, get it as big as he can for his cause.
And according to the interviewer, that must have sounded like madness at the time, but now we have Iraq. And Abdul Bari Atwan says, it seems like Osama bin Laden had a long-term strategy. He told me personally he can't go and fight the Americans and their country, but if he manages to provoke them and bring them into the Middle East and into their Muslim worlds where he can find them or fight them on his own turf, he will actually teach them a lesson. It seems the invasion of Iraq fulfilled Osama bin Laden's wish. That's why the Americans are losing in Iraq financially and on a human basis, and even their allies are really losing patience, losing money, losing personnel, losing reputation in that part of the world. So, wait a minute. You're saying, so this guy does this terrible deed, is responsible for this awful attack on civilians in New York and in Pennsylvania, and we're supposed to do nothing? There's supposed to be no response to this criminal act now. It was absolutely appropriate to invade Afghanistan to punish, destroy, apprehend Al-Qaeda. It was absolutely improper to go into Iraq since Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11, and is absolutely insane, as we've seen now in Afghanistan and all the destruction and death that's occurring there and U.S. casualties as well, to try to remake the Afghan government.
And, you know, Osama bin Laden, we've been saying this for years now. He is now Osama bin Forgotten, really.
Yeah, they don't even bring him up that much
anymore. Why aren't they after him?
But this is what Bush said. Bush said, free Iraq is within reach. And as he was telling, naturally, he went to a veterans group, the Veterans of Foreign Wars. And he's certainly swelling their membership, isn't he?
Well, he is. He certainly is. And he certainly has stirred things up.
Yeah.
Hasn't he?
Vietnam.
Once again.
He mentioned the V word.
He did. When, as we were just talking about that a little bit ago, a year ago, you know, he was scoffing at anyone who made the comparisons of Iraq and Vietnam, and now he's doing it for his benefit.
And it's not working real well. He's really catching lots of criticism, as he should. Now, Bush was a draft dodger. And I think, given that the war in Vietnam was based on a whole pack of lies, just the way the Iraq war was, and by by 1968 or 1969, most people realized it was a losing proposition, including Nixon. And that's why they began a withdrawal in 1969 or so. The process was called Vietnamization, and it was to take out American troops and to allow the South Vietnamese forces to fight the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army. So Bush, in the meantime, has got a rich father, as we know. So he manages to scam out of the draft by getting his father's connection, using his father's connection to get him to jump over all these other applicants in the Texas Air National Guard, because nobody wanted to go. as John Kerry said, who was going to be the last man to die in Iraq? In this, in Vietnam. And you could apply it to Iraq as well. So people like Cheney, of course, he had all his deferments. But the deal was that all these Republicans that are mid-50s and up, they supported the war. They were these flag wavers for the war in Vietnam, but they sure weren't going to fight it. That was up to the working class guys. That was up to the minority kids to go there and lose a total of like four. You know, there was 400,000 casualties, U.S. casualties.
Oh, my
God. I mean, we forget about it. There was 58,000 to 60,000 deaths there, but there were 350,000 men wounded. Mm-hmm. In Vietnam. So the fact that we're always talking about how the Vietnam vets still haunt us, I mean, one of the reasons was that they suffered such grievous injuries.
Absolutely. They continue to debilitate them to this day, and they're getting completely ripped off by their own government, who they fought for.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bush, in his rousing defense of his Iraq policy on Wednesday at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Kansas City, said that then as now, people argued the real problem was America's presence, and if we would just withdraw, the killing would end. He said that the world would learn just how costly these misimpressions would be. Let's see. As the battle lines are drawn... I'm skipping ahead here. The administration... God, I got so much of this here.
Well, once again,
yeah.
He's... What planet is this guy on?
I don't know.
Really?
You know, because
I think it starts with a U.
Yeah, that planet, what is it? Uranus. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Out there by Pluto.
Which is no longer a planet.
Yeah. They got downgraded, didn't I? I forgot about that. But this is terrible. So Bush, who scammed out of the war. Now, it was absolutely monstrous that there was a draft that forced young men to go and fight, to kill and be killed in Vietnam when they didn't want to. So if you were a draft dodger and opposed the war, at least that's ethically consistent. You could argue whether people still should have or not, but it's ethically consistent. If you're a right-wing, pro-war, warmonger like young Bush and young Cheney were in 1968, 1970, and what have you, it's absolutely unethical, immoral, despicable, reprehensible. And I guess I would apply those adjectives to these pretenders to the throne.
They all work.
Yeah, they all work. But I was looking for something else in here. Oh, by the way, this is funny. I wonder if Jim Rutenberg, who wrote this story for the New York Times, he must know. As the battle lines are drawn, you know that song from Buffalo Springfield, you know, something, battle lines being drawn.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. A new advertising war is beginning to heat up, focusing on lawmakers, especially Republicans, who face tough reelection campaigns. On Wednesday, a new interest group, Freedom's Watch, led by allies of the Bush administration, including Sheldon Adelson, a Las Vegas casino magnate who ranks sixth on the Forbes magazine's list of world billionaires, began a month-long $15 million campaign intended to support the president's policy.
Oh, good for him.
So this multi-billionaire, Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas gambler, is encouraging a continuation of this cauldron, of this quagmire, of this meat grinder.
Wow, Peter. Oh, you're on fire.
Yeah. And guess who their spokesperson is? Ari Fleischer.
Remember our buddy who had that column every week, Ari and Me?
Oh, yeah.
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 He used to really, really go at it with Ari Fleischer.
Okay, here's the part I was looking for.
He's resurfaced. They always resurface in a big job with big money.
And no consequences for being another one of the big liars about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Exactly.
In a passage of his speech that set off a bitter debate even before the speech's end, Bush suggested a quick pullout from Iraq could bring the kind of carnage that drenched Southeast Asia 3 decades ago. And this is Bush now, and he must have a new speechwriter. He's not this eloquent, obviously. In Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge began a murderous rule in which hundreds of thousands of Cambodians died by starvation and torture and execution. Actually, he's minimizing it. It was probably 1,300,000 people that died under Khmer Rouge rule. In Vietnam, former allies of the United States were sent off to prison camps. Tens of thousands perished. Hundreds of thousands fled the country. It was this enormous, as he said, does he use the word carnage here somewhere? No, that was just in the description. Well, why in the hell, I mean, let me take back that phrase because I want to use the word hell otherwise. Why did this happen? Well, because of the U.S. invasion of Southeast Asia, again, based totally on a lie, the United States had no reason to invade and to destroy this country and kill 3 million civilians. Now, if this is awful, which it is, the Khmer Rouge killed 1.3 million people. What does it say about us, a country that sent our soldiers that wound up killing 3 million civilians, doused the country with Agent Orange, with the birth defects still showing up in Indochinese children that left 400,000 of our people. And this is what he points to. This is what he points to. That they opened the gates of hell by destroying Indochinese social society. This is what they did. Remember, they had this thing called Operation Phoenix. So these, well, I shouldn't say remember. Many of you might, may not. And this was where the United States pinpointed the infrastructure, the social infrastructure in Vietnam particularly, and assassinated and whatever was necessary to take out the leaders of these villages. And so it was an arena of madness. And this is in which and this is what how the Khmer Rouge arose. And what do we see now? The same thing. That they opened up the gates of hell in Iraq. So you have these maniacs, these murderous men cutting the heads off of other people, blowing up marketplaces and what have you. This is Bush. This is Bush.
I have an observation.
Part. Yeah, sorry, I'm going to sit back here.
No.
I'm going to drink my tea.
Well, my observation is you can tell that Karl Rove is kind of out of there because he never would have let Bush say any of this.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right.
Just a thought.
Here's what Vu Hoai Tru of Hanoi, a veteran of the communist forces that fought American troops in Vietnam. He says, doesn't Bush realize that if the U.S. had stayed in Vietnam longer, they would have killed more people? Nobody regrets that the Vietnam War wasn't prolonged except Bush.
Yeah.
This is the only man on the planet that thinks we should have fought to the last working class kid in America or the last African American or a Latino kid in America.
Yeah, while he sat back and snorted up half of Peru.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
rat boy.
This true, T-R-I-E-U, said, he said U.S. troops would have never prevailed in Vietnam. Does he think the U.S. could have won if they would have stayed longer? No way. And also, though, he talks about, you know, this immediate withdrawal. There was no United States troops fighting in there after 1973 and the final withdrawal, that ignominious final withdrawal from the top of that building in 1975, with 2 years after that. So,
shame on him once again.
Yeah, yeah.
And all why right. is he still in office?
Why is he still in office? Let's see. Here is Ralph. Ralph's in Detroit, and he joins us at 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby with Jalene Jordan. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air. Oh, wait a minute here. Go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Simply put, I think Bush is still in office because people looking at it as if, I think the powers that are be that could get him out of office, feels like this is what, August now? He's not going to be in office, but for how many months longer? How many much longer months?
Well, until January 21st,
too long?
2009.
Yeah.
Yes, that is too long, but then you got to think about the process and how long it takes, how much money it's going to take, the evidence. Well, the evidence is already there, but the manpower and everything else that has to go into it. And then you also have to remember that the Democrats just got control of the houses, you know what I'm saying? And that,
I don't know, Ralph. It was quite a few months ago now. I mean,
it's been a minute, but in comparison to how long he's been in office and when he should have been through in prison,
yeah,
or impeached at least, you know, he should have been impeached within his first 2 years of being in office, in my opinion.
He never should have been in office.
Yeah, well, since his mistakes, at best, other people think it's even worse than that, but at best, through what they call misfeasance, the failure to properly discharge his duties and allowed September 11th to occur, why didn't that just blast him out of office? Thank you, Ralph. Thank you for joining us. Pardon me. Let's see. Here is Mike. Mike is in Pontiac. Mike, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Good.
I'm a fairly regular listener to your show, and I have a fairly straightforward answer as to why President Bush is still in office.
Hmm.
Vanity and capitalism.
And the Democrats.
No, vanity and capitalism. People are vain. Capitalism runs rampant. Voters become apathetic because they get what they want. They can go to McDonald's and buy a cheeseburger. They can drive down the street to Walmart and get a television for $25 at midnight. These are the things that people believe make them happy. Ideal of the American dream.
Well, it doesn't have that impact that people don't think it has that direct impact. But now there's been I forget what it is, 1 million or 2 million men and women that have been through Iraq. We're at 30,000 casualties, almost 4,000 killed. The slaughter still goes on, the intercommunal slaughter in Iraq. The money keeps going to these corrupt contractors, on and on and on.
But it doesn't affect the average working man. Nobody feels it because they borrow the money from China, so nobody notices it. Nobody makes a sacrifice. There's no tax hike to pay for the war. It doesn't affect the average working guy, so therefore he becomes apathetic to the situation.
Well,
nobody sees the outcome.
They think it doesn't. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Right, it's the illusion. It's the illusion that the war is free, and that's where the apathy comes from, and the ability, to just blatant commercialism. The wealthiest portion of the people in this country control the voters through monetary incentives.
Yeah. Hey, Mike.
They deceive people into buying this.
Mike, you know what's going on in your town on Tuesday? You aware of this?
No, I unfortunately work 18 hours a day trying to pay my bills.
Oh, well, President Bush would be proud of you, remember?
And your tax dollars are going to pay for this war.
Yeah, he was at some forum and some woman said
thank you.
That she works three jobs, and she says, three jobs, isn't that wonderful? Give her a big hand. Well, I'll tell you anyways, even though maybe you can get some time out to do it. There's something going on called Iraq Summer, and there's 100 organizers are working to involve Americans in an effort to pressure targeted members of Congress to vote to bring the war in Iraq to an end. And the campaign is going to culminate in town meetings to be held this Tuesday, August 28th, immediately before Congress reconvenes. There's going to be 52 town meetings held across the country, and one is going to be in Pontiac, Michigan. In fact, they invited me to speak at it, but I had something else that I had to do, so I couldn't speak at it. The group is called Americans Against Escalation in Iraq, and it's a town hall forum, Take a Stand Against Endless War in Iraq. It's going to be local activists, clergy, and community leaders, and they're going to make statements in support of getting the troops out of there, out of the civil war in Iraq. It's going to be Tuesday, August 28th, 6:45, 6:45, this Tuesday, at Central High School in Pontiac, Michigan, 300 West Huron Street. Now, you can go to, let me see, what's the name of the group again? Oh, yeah, Americans Against Escalation in Iraq, if you're listening somewhere else in the country, and find out where some of these other 52 meetings are. So if you got an hour or two free, Mike, on that night, give it a whirl. All right, thank you very much. Thanks for calling. Yeah, those are the kind of community meetings where you start linking up with people and things don't feel quite as hopeless as they might. All right, let's see. Here's Brian in Ypsilanti. Brian, hi, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter. Hello, Jolene. And I wanted to thank you for adding me as a friend on MySpace.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I have two accounts. You add me on both. Brian, and well, I won't add my last name, but the C. You may have looked at some of the artwork. But the
beautiful artwork.
But, Brian, let me just say, since you mentioned it, you people can go to myspace.com/nightcalldetroit. So it's myspace.com. /NightCallDetroit. And,
yeah.
And what do they? They can just become our friend?
They can become our friend. If be our friend.
If you know what that's all about, if you don't like, I just go visit it. Jalene takes care of it.
We just took a new photo that will be going up.
Oh, we did.
Too. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Brian.
Fresh.
Okay, no problem. The reason why I called is I was wondering, I've heard like rumors and like conspiracy theories about microchip implants, or at this point might be Pico chip or femtochip implants going into people and doing away with the money system. And I was wondering what if you'd heard anything, or what was your opinion on such?
Well, you certainly hear about it all over the internet, and there's a lot of conspiracy theories everywhere, from 9/11 to this North American Union that's going to be set up between Mexico and the United States and Canada. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, the fact that we're as a nation pretty much sitting by, where the man who is sitting in the office of president has broken the law innumerable times, broken international conventions about torture and war and imprisoning people, reversing the 700-year right to habeas corpus, and on and on and on. And he's still sitting in there. I don't know. I mean, they probably could think, you know, these people will eat anything. Absolutely anything.
Hey, good luck getting a microchip in this girl.
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck.
The thing that makes me mention is I saw the Manchurian Candidate just recently, the one with Denzel Washington and what have you, and it's just something that I listen to your show quite a bit, and I've thoroughly enjoyed your opinions, both of yours, and I was just wondering what you thought of it.
Hey, Brian, have you ever seen the original Manchurian Candidate?
No, I haven't.
It's such a different movie. And, you know, it's black and white, and it's Lawrence Harvey and Frank Sinatra and Janet Leigh and a number of other really, you know, prominent actors from the late 50s, early 60s. And I think it's way superior. And if you can get it on DVD, in fact, don't get it except on DVD, because some of the old prints are kind of washed out and all that. But I just saw a new print of it, and it's absolutely startlingly beautiful. And the ending, since you know the ending to the Denzel Washington one, you will absolutely be shocked by the ending of this one.
Well, there's one more point I wanted to bring up. And that is that I know that there's on telephones, when you call certain places, there's like voice pattern recognition.
Yeah.
Do you think that they would ever have the ability to come up with thought pattern recognition?
Hey, their little minds are always working. They have people. That's all they do.
No.
That's all they do. Thank you, Brian.
Brian, are you paranoid?
Well, are you paranoid if they're really after you?
We should all be a little paranoid, right?
Right. And when did I just
making
saw,
me paranoid. That's all I'm saying.
Well, somebody just sent me an email, and the signature.
Okay.
Was it said paranoia is total awareness.
Oh my.
Oh my.
And there's also paranoia will destroy you.
Yeah. Right. And paranoia runs deep into your heart. It will creep, seep.
And how about paranoia? Put the bong down.
Okay. All right. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. We'll be right back. Our numbers are 313-298-WRIF. If the lines are filled, or if you're shy, you go to calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and can't end it here. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Down by myself, and I've had too much caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was, in platform double suede. Yeah, there she was, like disco lemonade. Yeah. I smell sex and can't hold it, yeah. Who's that lounging? Yeah. Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this Charlotte is a dream. Yeah, yeah, mama, this Charlotte is a dream. Yeah.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. You can call us at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And we opened the show with this information that the CIA had just absolutely dropped the ball on September 11th.
And this is something new? That's what I know. It's not. We knew this.
And also that Bush's speech to the veterans of foreign wars, whose ranks he's filling rapidly, he said that a free Iraq is within reach, and I just don't,
agree?
No, look at all the stories I have about this.
Yeah.
Let me just read the headlines.
This is kind of the story that has lasted all week.
Report, there's a new, this national intelligence estimate casts strong doubts on the viability of the Bush administration's strategy in Iraq. The government's going to hell. More Iraqis said to flee since the U.S. troop increase. These are just the headlines, folks. Iraq body count running at double pace.
Mm-hmm.
This year's U.S. troop buildup has succeeded in bringing violence to Baghdad down from peak levels, but the death toll from sectarian attacks around the country is running nearly double the pace from a year ago.
Well, as far as the refugees go, you hear about the refugee crises all over the world, but this is the biggest refugee crisis of current times.
In Baghdad itself, armed groups increasingly control the switching stations that channel electricity around Iraq. U.S. troops kill 8 during Baghdad fight. You think, what's the big deal about that? But that the United States using attack helicopters in this packed city that they get in a fight with these insurgents, and they just start strafing these buildings and killing these civilians that are sleeping on the roofs. That winning hearts and minds. Number of Iraqis held by the U.S. in Iraq is swelling. It's up by
50%.
50%. Shiite militia expands grip in Baghdad. This is and Bush is saying that free Iraq is within reach. This man is he must be
delusional.
He is. Fallujah's calm is seen as fragile if U.S. leaves. It'll all go to hell. And on and on and on and on and on. And will everything go to hell if the United States leaves? It probably will.
It's going to hell whether we're there or not.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's quit killing innocent civilians and our people who are over there. Let's stop it.
Yeah, and where's the political will? The American people want it stopped. The Iraqi people want it stopped. U.S. soldiers want it stopped. So the only people that are still maintaining it is these psycho incompetent neocons. Here's Kim in Clarkston. I'm having a bad night. Kim
in Clarkston.
There you go.
Welcome to the program.
Yeah, there you go.
It's Kim and Clarkson.
There you go.
We got it.
But after you just said that stuff about being psycho and everything, I'm just wondering what you guys are thinking. I mean, I am a flower child from way back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I'm anti-war and everything. But what do you think about these guys that come over here and can just suicide bomb us in London and everywhere else and just go ahead and get away with it? Are we just supposed to just let them go?
No.
And say, okay,
well, wait a minute.
We're just going to back down?
Brad, wait. What does Iraq have to do with this?
Iraq, Iran, it just...
What does Iran have to do with it? We're over there. Come on, Kim. They're not over here, not the Iraqis, not the Iranians. I mean, the people that were involved in September 11th, you've probably heard this 150 times before.
They were Saudis.
We're Saudi Arabians. This is our ally. This is who we're going to give $20 billion worth of military loans to out of your and my tax dollars when our state can't even balance its budget. We're so out of money.
Going over there, bombing them.
Yeah, but how messed up is it that we're...
And then we're going and spending all our money to go ahead and rebuild their cities and everything. I think it's ridiculous.
No, I agree. Yeah. And there's not, you know, if we bombed them, we actually should have some ethical duty to repair them. But what happens is it just goes to like Cheney's company, Halliburton, and they don't even get it built. Most of the stuff that our tax dollars, the billions of dollars that we've spent in reconstruction, these projects have never even been successful. So the electricity grid gets worse and worse. The schools don't operate. The water purification plants, the hospitals are nothing. It's, and the money winds up somewhere. It's just because a project doesn't go online the way it's supposed to doesn't mean somebody hasn't wound up with our tax dollars, right?
Right.
Okay.
So if you come over and bomb our country, we will reward you and then go after someone else.
All right.
It just makes no sense.
It doesn't. Let's see here. Here is Samantha in Redford. Hi, Samantha. You're on WRIF with Peter and Jolene.
Hey, I just want to talk about how, like, we should pull out of Iraq, but we can't just, like, drop it all and pull out.
Okay, so a slow process,
yeah.
You say?
Yeah, kind of like we did with the Korean Wars and everything. Like, we still have people there to, like, maintain it. Like, we're not like, oh, well, you know, we're the U.S. and we're going to beat you up, whatever. Like, you know, like, they're over there to make sure it doesn't, like, go to complete chaos, because that's what's going to happen if we just drop everything and walk out of, like,
I don't
Iraq.
Think you have to worry about that, because there's no way they're going to do it.
Well, I'll tell you, Samantha, the idea that the United States, after having destroyed the social fabric of Iraq by its illegal and unnecessary invasion, is that if we leave, the country would, I don't know, I mean, could it fall into worse chaos? I suppose the kind of intercommunal violence that's going on could escalate. But the idea then this becomes blackmail. So then the United States keeps fighting. And the United States is just one. The United States forces there are just one of the many armies that are fighting for different aspects of control there. And there's these shifting alliances, because sometimes now you read that the United States is actually arming these Sunni groups against these Shia groups. And the Shia groups, which use the United States for our tax dollars to rebuild, it doesn't happen, but supposedly
to pretend to rebuild
the infrastructure and to give them protection from the insurgents, are actually allied with these bitter enemies of the U.S., like this Mahdi army and what have. So it's absolutely an intractable, insolvable problem that Bush has been able to get us into. I suppose at some point, if the United States declared that it was going to go off on, wasn't going to launch any operational offensive patrols, and that's, I don't even know.
Attacks. Yeah. You know, there's the other angle, too, that we've talked about many times, Peter, is that the reason for the escalation of the insurgency is because we are there. So there's the thought that if we, you know, slowly withdraw, get out of there, that the insurgency will decrease, because they're mad. And that they're mad at us. That's why they're doing this.
Yeah. And there's like now they... think a million Iraqi civilians have died because of the U.S. invasion. That doesn't mean that the United States forces have killed all a million, all million, 1 million.
Right.
But these are the forces that have been unleashed. The Civil
These are
War.
The numbers.
Yeah. The disease. The you know, everything that's going on. And actually, that in these battles, when civilians wind up as collateral damage, whether the insurgents are fighting, you know, among them or whatever the excuses for collateral damage, when you're sleeping on a roof and it's 113 in Baghdad and a U.S. attack helicopter comes and strafes this whole block of buildings and your wife and child get killed, what do you think that recruits you to, right?
You know, that's pretty lame. But, like, I think my thought on that, like, with this whole, like, pretty much Thai wars, like, it's a huge civil war that we're pretty much refereeing and, like, sticking our noses in. And it's just pretty much, like, it's turned into a war based on religion and money.
Well, yeah. And two of the most malign forces in the world today. Yeah. People fighting over religion, as they've been doing for the last 1,000 years or so. And, of course, driven by greed and control of resources and control of wealth. I mean, that's why Bush and them are there. I mean, control of oil and the capacity to control this decreasingly available resource. Okay, thank you very much, Samantha. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, she's on the right track.
Yeah, yeah. Here's Daryl in Davison, Michigan. Daryl, how you doing? You're on the air. You're up there near Fenton, aren't you?
Actually, quite a ways from Fenton, yes.
Are you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the home
near Lapeer, I guess you might say, on the other side of Flint.
Right. The home of John Sinclair, if you know who that is.
City of Flags. Davis.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I may be on the wrong topic. I just tuned in moments ago, but I was curious as if Peter, if you guys have heard anything in regard to martial law with Bush training the clergy and different men of the cloth to slow down any quell that might happen in martial law, like maybe coming up sometime or another. Have you heard of anything of that?
Well, yeah, you may be mixing a couple of things in together. I mean, one thing is that that there has been this Christianization of the U.S. military, again, completely trashing and shredding the Constitution that says that Congress shall establish, no religion. And the Pentagon allows in the as partners these far right wing fundamentalist apocalyptic Christians that see this as the final battle between the Antichrist and all that, and it's absolutely inappropriate, and it's extraordinarily dangerous. You don't want Christian soldiers. That's not what this nation is all about. And the other thing, martial law, Bush has essentially signed an executive order that says that in case there's a situation where there is a natural or man-made disaster, like another 9/11, that he will become the guarantor of constitutional rule. So essentially, he's announced that he could become the dictator of the United States.
Right.
It's
right.
There. The mechanism is there.
Yeah. And then take our. I guess with that martial law and him signing that particular form that you mentioned with the Pentagon, we would actually have the clergy and so forth, army men, whatever, taking our guns from us, like they did something. I think they did something like that when they had that storm down in Louisiana.
Really? Well, you can kind of Google this if you use the internet. There's a lot written about it, to be sure. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Listen, we've got some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here's James in Kenosha, Wisconsin. James, hi, you're on the air. Wait a minute. Is this one of these things where I got to push the button? Yeah, there we go. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
Hey, Jalene, how you doing?
James, hey, I want to thank you for the invite. There's a Rage Against the Machine show there.
You should have been there.
Oh, you saw
it? Oh, it already happened. Oh.
It happened. Friday night.
Yeah. I tell you, I work very hard, and I wasn't able to answer you, but he caught on to the fact that I'm a huge Rage Against the Machine fan and invited me to go to the show, and
nice.
How was it?
The show was, I've seen a whole lot of shows in my years, and there's a lot of years, and this thing ranks. It's got to be in the top 10.
Really?
In terms of energy, in terms of just the absolute fire that was coming from both the stage and from the crowd, it was amazing. There were approximately, I guess it holds around 30,000, and it was full up.
And was Zach speaking out at all politically?
During, like he did at Coachella and Rock the Bells during the song Wake, he did a rant, you know, referencing the Fox News dust-up and the whole bit. But then he turned it a little bit further, and he says, you know, it's got me thinking, what are these fascists afraid of? Are they afraid of this little band, four band members from California and our songs or our lyrics? He says, no, they're afraid of you.
Huh.
Because you're the ones who have the power to throw them out of office and get rid of these guys. And then he goes, and the Democrats are afraid of you because they know that you can see through their BS.
And we're on to them, right.
And he's like, and that if they, you know, and then he got a little bit off into the Tripping the Life Fantastic, that, you know, we would take the power and burn down every office of every senator who wasn't doing the job. And that it's time for all of you to wake up. And then they went into the song Wake Up. And it was
very cool.
I'm telling you, it was pretty stunning. It was a stunning show.
I wish I could have been there.
I wish you had been there. I mean, it was a bizarre invitation, to be sure. What the hell?
It's okay, James.
We had a blowout on the way, so.
You gotta take risks in life, right?
Once in a while, yeah. At least calculated ones.
Right.
I called, though, in response to the first article you wrote about the CIA falling down on the job.
About 9/11. Yeah.
Well, about 9/11, but I think perhaps that's a bit of a gambit that you're taking on their part. It's another distraction. It's not a reflection on Bush. It's a distraction from Bush. And if we think, you know, we know full well, if they totally drop the ball, that doesn't explain the infamous August PDB or whatever, that the presidential briefing of Bin Laden determined to attack
sure.
the United States. That came from the CIA.
Yeah, Bush had the information that there was going to be a domestic attack within the United States, and he just was clearing brush and Crawford.
Oh, remember that? Yeah.
So I got a feeling, and the other part of this deal is we now know just how the CIA's intelligence at the gathering was corrupted, perverted, the whole process by Cheney and his gang. Visiting Quantico, wasn't that Quantico? And twisting arms, basically. We don't know if they were doing the same thing prior to 9/11. It is a possibility. But so I think, you know, and the guy that would take the fall, George Tenet,
sure.
they bought him off with this Medal of Freedom. You think for a minute Bush Cheney wants to see an investigation of the CIA and their practices and have Tenet come and testify in front of Congress now?
Well, they must be terrified in general of the, you know, what history is in you know, history in the near term is going to show. I mean, as it is, some of these investigations that have occurred have been incredibly damning, except they just get very little play in the media. James, thank you so much. I appreciate your call.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye now. Got to go to spots. When we got to go, we've got
commercials.
Commercials. Yeah, people don't know what spots are. Got to go to spots.
Talking about radio speed,
wow.
Peter.
Yeah. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. The show is Night Call. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. Hang on. We'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, I'm going to be interviewing Reese Ehrlich. He's just written a book called The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Mideast Crisis, and also Larry Burns, who is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. And we're going to be talking about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
He's an interesting guy.
He's a character.
Yeah. So
I love him.
He actually makes a sometimes dry subject sound less dry.
I was going to say, both that Council on Hemispheric Affairs and the North American Free Trade. Well, we're talking about our pocketbooks. We're talking about what's happening in the Detroit area and Michigan economically, and how we're being systematically looted. All right. Oh, yeah. All that information and some links to the guests and lots of other stuff as well are at Peter Werby, W-E-R-B as in boy E, peterwerby.com. In fact, I've got this long clip, some of you may have seen it, to Bush and the Vietnam analogy on The Daily Show.
Oh, okay.
Did you see that?
I haven't seen it yet.
I was watching it, I think last night maybe, and my wife saying, what are you laughing? I mean, I usually don't laugh out loud uproariously at television.
Don't watch TV.
Well, this was the link on. I wasn't watching.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm debating whether to do this, but I'm going to go ahead because P.T. Barnum said any publicity is good publicity as long as they spell your name right.
True. Which with a name like mine, they never get my name right.
Your first name
Jalene,
spelled J U L I N E.
And well, no one gets you. They call you Peter Werby.
Peter Werby. Yeah. But we're talking about the Crawford Wild Man, the Texas Wild Man. He used to be the Motor City Madman.
Are you going to go there, Peter?
I am going to go
All
there.
Right.
I'm going to go there because this was in RollingStone.com/rock. And Roll Daily, and the headline is Ted Nugent threatens to kill Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton during vicious onstage rant. I mean, he is really a sandwich short of a picnic.
Okay, how did he say it?
Well, you got to watch the video. You can just kind of Google it. I was going to put it on my site. No, he was. He's for one thing. He's dressed in an American flag shirt.
That's his favorite shirt. I wonder if he's washed it. Remember, we've seen him in it a few times.
Isn't that like flag desecration or something like that?
Well, maybe not in Ted's world.
Like 30 or 40 years ago, Abby Hoffman wore that. He wore an American flag shirt into a congressional hearing.
Yeah,
You remember?
I remember.
You were there.
About it.
Oh, okay. I mean, and he was attacked by the police. The shirt was ripped off him, and he was arrested for flag desecration.
Yes.
Of course, now you can have little flag bikinis, right?
Yes, they have those.
Where was I? Oh, yeah, Bed Bath and Beyond. Can you imagine me at Bed Bath and Beyond? I wanted to know what's beyond. That was the most. But they had about 1,000 flags.
Only you would wonder that.
I said, "Where's the?" I said to this woman, "Where's the
Beyond
they
section.
Work there?" I said, "Where's the Beyond section?" And she walked away. Security.
She probably thought you meant the adult room.
Yeah, I don't know. My wife is looking at coffee makers. I want to anyway. So they had all these flags, and I looked, made in Korea.
Didn't it's that time of year, you know. There's a holiday coming up, so you know.
What holiday?
Every holiday.
4th of July?
Labor Day. Every holiday
yeah,
they'll put
right.
up the flag.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be marching with my union down Woodward Avenue.
Yes, you will be every year.
American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFL-CIO. So here's Nugent. They refer to him as renegade right-winger. Why is he a renegade? He's the mainstream right-winger. Just rage and the most base insults. Now, I don't care that he insults Hillary Clinton or Obama. Barack Obama.
Okay.
The fact that he is any kind of verbal abuse in terms of calling them the kind of names that I call Bush, you know, incompetent, psycho, fascist.
Yeah, we all do
communist.
It, right?
Yeah. That's all right.
But to threaten to kill them.
Well, yeah. He's decked out in full camo, and then he had his flag shirt on as well, wielding two machine guns.
What?
While raging, yeah, Obama, he's a piece of S. I told him to suck on my machine gun. Hey, Hillary, you might want to ride one of these into the sunset, you worthless bitch.
Oh, my gosh.
And then he's summing up his eloquent speech, it says here, by screaming, freedom! So the guy is a whack job supreme. I'm so glad he moved to Crawford, Texas. And what a, you know, he always makes bad choices. I can remember when he was an air personality in Detroit. I don't know. You weren't here. You weren't in.
Yes, I was
were
here.
You, were you here? Okay.
Peter has been here a lot longer than you remember.
So normally I don't like to give someone like that any publicity. And someone said, hey, look, he's got a new album out. He's on tour. He's coming here to Detroit. And so any publicity is good publicity. And we are actually doing his job. Doing his job for him, or doing a job for him, I guess you'd say. Remember, there is this right-wing woman in Detroit whose name we never mentioned. We just called the right-wing bitch from hell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
she is.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah, but we're not going to say her name.
No.
And then there, and I always said, well, more prominent person who we, I think when this is when I was doing work on the Air America Network, mm-hmm. I'd refer to that that woman whose stock and trade is just making outrageous statements about the, like the 9/11 widow. And all. Don't say her name.
The blonde?
The blonde, yeah.
Okay.
The blonde. And who I just referred to as TDP, that dreadful person. And I said on the air.
So mean.
I said, either you'll know who she is, and then I don't have to say her name and give her more publicity, or if you don't, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, according to Elizabeth Goodman, who wrote this article for Rolling Stone, this isn't the first time Nugent has been caught spewing hatred, don't you think? Last January, the guitarist caused a scandal for Republican Texas Governor Rick Perry when he wore a Confederate flag shirt to the inauguration and insulted immigrants. Now, Nugent was quoted in a Wall Street Journal story blaming, quote, stone dirty stinking hippies for the rising rates of divorce, high school dropouts, drug use, abortion, sexual diseases, and crime, not to mention the exponential expansion of government and taxes.
He's blaming us for all that? Oh, jeez.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, on this, now you can always make comments on stories that are in the news.
Right.
So all the comments were really funny. They'd say, this guy's making fun of hippies? Take a look at him. You know, he's got this
long hair
and all this.
Living
and,
off the land.
And he claims, of course, that he had never done drugs ever. Well,
yeah.
he lived in Detroit. He, you know, he was his first group was the Amboy Dukes, which was named after there was a book called The Amboy Dukes that was written in the 40s about a teenage gang that killed people and all that. Mm-hmm. And they
he's always kind of been this way.
They lived in a house called the Dukes House, and you know, with they're total stoners. So if he wasn't doing drugs, he was the only one there that wasn't. That could be.
It could be. Yeah.
Now, the whole thing about dirty, stinky hippies. Now, what year is this, Ted? Are you having some acid? Oh, no, you didn't do any acid. I was going to say acid flashback.
Yeah.
But are there a lot
it's
of...
It's scary that he's that way naturally.
Yeah. Are there a lot of stone, dirty, stinky hippies around?
No.
So what is he talking
I'm
about?
A hippie, and I think I smell quite lovely. Thank you.
You do. You do. But now this is the problem with rising rates of divorce. That's all because of stone, dirty, stinky hippies.
Yeah, right.
High school dropouts are caused by dirty, stinky hippies.
Okay.
Drug use, abortion, sexual diseases, and crime, not to mention the exponential expansion of government and taxes.
What, is this guy Billy Graham?
He's a total lunatic. I mean, I used to say, well, he plays good guitar. I can't even stand to listen to him anymore. I can't even stand to his... I'm just glad he moved to Crawford. He moved out of Michigan. So now he's not the Motor City Madman. Although in the ads that like are playing here on WRI for his concert, they refer to him as the Motor City Madman. I'm thinking, he's not the Motor City Man. He's the Texas Wild Man.
He still has a lot of fans, though, on the show.
Yeah, well.
Have a good time.
Yeah, right. Rock. Oh, and people probably be thinking, wow, I want to hear him go off on a rant like that. So we have probably increased his ticket sales.
Well, you know, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So be it. I'm Peter Werby with Jalene Jordan here at Night Call, 313-298-WRIF, and there are some open lines. Here's Marianne in Dearborn. Hi, Marianne. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter, Jalene. Well, I think Ted Nugent is a festering syphilitic lesion on the arse of humanity, but enough about him.
Nice.
Let's see.
Well put.
Have you heard about the peace train starting at Royal Oak and going to Chicago for the big peace demonstration in October 27th?
No, please tell me.
There's a... a demonstration in Chicago on the 27th, so that would make it...
22nd.
About 27th, Saturday, October 27th.
Oh, October. October, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. It leaves, the Amtrak train leaves at 7 o'clock in the morning at Royal Oak and gets to Dearborn about 7:30, and it picks up in Ann Arbor and points along the way until it gets to Chicago.
Where's Cat Stevens now that we need him?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I hope you don't have to hear Cat Stevens all the way to Chicago.
And that's with Peace Action of Michigan.
Uh-huh.
Very cool.
Oh, here's a little fun fact for you. George Bush's grandmother went to England, and about 9 months, she went there to have sex magic rites with Aleister Crowley. And about 9 months later, this is a true story, Barbara Bush was born. this is no joke. It
really?
Sounds like one, but it's the truth.
Where you've got to send me a link to this.
I sure will.
I'll put this on my website. You can send it to call talk yes at yahoo.com.
That explains a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Rosemary's
okay.
Baby.
All right. Exactly.
All right, Marianne, thank you very much. And
there's a movie I've seen. Peter.
I might actually go on that. The idea of taking a train. And is it going to be back Sunday?
It's going to be back by, I think, 6 o'clock in the evening of the same day, on Saturday.
Well,
they're trying to get three cars. They're trying to fill up three cars.
I might do.
Sigrid can't
go
because she's going to be in Austria.
Oh, yeah. Sigrid, she sent us the information about the event on Tuesday in Pontiac, the big anti-war rally, the town meeting. And by the way, people, if you're sometimes at a loss, you'd like to take part in some public events, you can always go to my website, which is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and just click on the calendar on the left side. Plus, there's lots of other good stuff. Well, Marianne, keep us updated on that stuff, will you?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for that very interesting little tidbit.
Now, I would like to go on that. The only thing is, you know, the train ride, there's about 5 hours.
Yeah. So. Well, that would be, I could do that. I get off the air at 6 in the morning. I could get on that train at 7.
Peace train. Can you sing the Peace Train, the Old Cat Stevens? No.
No.
I wonder if I could, you know, I always used to, a couple of times I went to Washington on trains.
Yeah.
For big anti-war marches, and I'd always play poker.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And always won.
Right. You know me.
Yeah.
I'll just have my People magazine. Remember how that's how we calm down when we travel.
That's right. That's right. Here's Christina in West Bloomfield. Christina, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hi. I was calling about the reason I think Bush is still in office.
Yeah, sure.
Well, our society in general is becoming very passive. I've noticed, like, I'm a little older. I'm 37, so...
That's
it's
older?
Different now.
Okay.
Well, I've gone to the bars late, you know, and there's no more pool tables. There's no more dartboards. There's just TVs everywhere. And I've noticed the younger people tend to be really passive, you know, and I think people want him out, but nobody knows what to do or how to be active because they've grown up learning to be passive, with TV.
I think there's a lot of that, Christina, but think about like you and me, or you and me and Jolene. One of the things that we thought we could do, which again is fairly passive, is voting for elected representatives. And we got these people in there that we thought were going to make great strides towards turning back the trajectory of the Bush regime. And
what were we thinking?
Yeah, and on one hand, they have done a lot of investigations, but what's happened?
Nothing comes out of those.
Yeah.
No, there's no punishment. There's no repercussions.
There's no indictments.
There's a report, and we report on it. And then poof.
Yeah, and one of the things that the Republicans are doing, they're trying to shed the worst of what people identify with the excesses of the Bush regime. So they get rid of Rums. I wouldn't even be surprised. In fact, remember, I've got a little bit to go. That Cheney is actually going to resign,
and still nothing will matter.
Yeah, yeah, and that Gonzalez. I just saw this on the news today. Gonzalez may resign. You know that, and so like I said this last week. I I said to a friend of mine, I said, who's the Secretary of Defense now? And they went, you know, who's the head of the CIA? Who's the head of the Treasury? They've just got these faceless apparatchiks running the bureaucracy.
The big thing now in literature and everywhere is to think positive and to always, you know, if you think positive, then positive things happen. And Bush is very positive, so I think he fits that.
But that is not
what you're talking about.
No, no. Well, that's called delusional and all that positive thinking. What is that called? The Secret? Isn't that it?
Secret and where the bleep are we from? Or what the bleep are we doing here? And, lots of those.
Yeah, that.
You're not into that, Peter?
Well, I wouldn't say that is, first off, Christine, I wouldn't say that is literature. And secondly, it is.
Well, you know what? You know what I think, Peter? I think we need hope. People need hope right now.
Yeah.
And so we'll take things like that. And there are some very good lessons, I think, to be learned out of that. And trying to manifest things in your mind and have a positive attitude. And
I agree with that.
And I have friends who have told me their stories about proof that they believe this has worked for them. I'm manifesting that we are going to be on the air and bash Bush until 1 a.m.
Right, Christina, thank you so much for joining us. Let's go to Yale, Michigan. Here's Dan. Dan, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, sure. Go.
Well, I got a couple little tidbits to add to your show.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of how Bush came into his money, like how his family has?
Tell me.
Well,
yes.
From what I've heard, it's been large oil deals from overseas through about three generations back, from Bush's grandfather, his great-grandfather, that kind of thing. Well, guess what the name of the family that his family's been doing business with for the past 100 years?
Wait, I can answer.
What, who?
Bin Laden.
That is correct.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
But do I get a prize?
It goes back to other people in his family that did business with the Nazis and all that. I mean, it's really one of these dynasties that are extraordinarily shady. Hey, the Kennedy family had some pretty shady dealings as well, but nothing like this.
Well, I'm just saying, none of those people, none of the Kennedys attacked our own country.
No, I know.
Another thing is, isn't it kind of convenient that not only is our vice president the former head executive of a former oil company, but now they're the sole rights to all the oil that's possibly being able to be dripped from that land?
There you go.
That was one of his many failed businesses.
And then you got Bush, who ran not one, but two or three companies into the ground before he became a politician.
Yeah, he doesn't have, that's what I always say. Those guys make, because they're rich, they can make mistake after mistake after mistake, and
still win and still come out.
Nothing ever happens to them.
Gazillionaires.
Thank you, Dan. Here's a letter from another Dan, an email message, actually, and it's from Dan in Waterford. And very frequently on the show that I'm critical of religion, and Dan writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Peter and Jalene, you saw this, didn't you? Yeah, I copied you on it. I'm a longtime listener to your show via podcast, and you can get podcasts. Just go to wrif.com and search around in there. You can see.
And wait, you don't have to have an iPod. Oftentimes, I don't mean you. When people mention podcasts, they go, "Oh, I don't have an iPod." Basically, you just listen to it online.
Yeah, you can do that
as well. Go to wrif.com. Find us.
But Dan from Waterford says, I'm a progressive Catholic peace activist in the Detroit area, a member of Pax Christi, P-A-X-C-H-R-I-S-T-I, Christian peace.
Remember I marched with that monk who had a sign that said that down in Florida.
And on the steering committee of the Michigan Stop the Bombs campaign, the folks who are working to close the nuclear bomb plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, I have a couple of comments about your last show. And I was, these people who I have this incredible respect for, these Christian peace activists and people involved in social justice campaigns. But I said, unfortunately, they're minority of a minority of a minority. Or I think I said a footnote of a footnote of a footnote.
Mm-hmm.
And that overwhelmingly all the major religions of the world have pretty much been a bloody sword. And Christopher Hitchens, That's interesting. His name is Christopher. Christopher Hitchens, who's just written a book about atheism that remains on the New York Times bestseller list, who wrote a book called God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And this, all of a sudden, has taken on... I mean, Bush has done such damage to Christianity that people have really gotten in touch with their atheism and all their... And they said, guy, they said, man, if that guy knows... Yeah, man, if that guy's a Christian, I'm an atheist. So I said, and throughout history, that there's this terrible, the history is terrible of most of these religions. But Dan says, hey, give us a break. We're just getting started. The rulers have oppressed the working class for 10,000 years. Most religions have only been around for a small part of that. In the case of Christianity, it's clear that until the 1960s, very few Christians understood Jesus' message of creative nonviolence. It's true we don't have a majority yet, but we are making good progress. The Pax Christi group I belong to at St. Leo's is called St. Leo's Pax Christi in Detroit has increased from just a few members to over 50 in the last 10 years, and there are 9 other Detroit area Pax Christi groups now. Well, progress seems a little slower. Is it the glass half empty or half full, Dan?
You know, the churches that are really taking off are these new rock and roll churches where you can wear casual clothes and they play Led Zeppelin. I swear, they do.
Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah.
I know. Then he lists all the religious people, Dorothy Day, who's a very interesting woman. You might want to Google her, Dorothy Day, Albert Einstein, and a lot of other people.
How about those two, the pastors or...
Oh, yeah, Philip and Daniel Berrigan.
Yeah.
He mentions them, the two priests that spent...
The priests, right.
...good parts of their life in jail for civil disobedience.
Yeah.
He said, I would say the religious folks are the leaders of the peace and justice movement. Demanding peace with justice uses nonviolence. And as long as we can keep the neocons from using their nukes, we've got a chance. On another note, September 20th to 26th, Arlington Midwest, The Human Cost of War, comes to Detroit's Grand Circus Park, Woodward and Adams downtown, and they're going to display thousands of crosses and other religious symbols to represent the American dead. This is something that's happened all across the country. Well,
that'll be a nice difference from the abortion crosses I have to drive by a couple times every year on Woodward.
Well, here's what I would say. I don't ever get in these people's face because, like I say, I think they're doing good work on the planet. And they mostly attribute it to, the as he said, the message of Jesus read correctly, that it isn't about blessing opposing armies. It's not about the Crusades. It's not about burning witches. It's not about the Inquisition. It's not about, my religion fighting your religion and all of that. But it's about this this message of nonviolence, of peace, and social justice. Well, I don't know. I mean,
I'm glad you're there. We're glad you're doing it. Thank you.
But what about these people? What do they mean? If it wasn't for their religion, that they would be stealing and murdering, and well, they're good people. Period.
Yeah.
So it's kind of presumptuous for me to challenge them to say that if it wasn't for your religion, you'd still have the same basic set of ethics and beliefs and political views.
But do you think that?
I do.
Okay.
Of course I do. Yeah. I mean, I don't think they'd be awful. These are wonderful people. These are the people that we want in a new world. When we say a new world is possible, it's possible because of these people.
Makes me think of the David Rovick song, After the Revolution. Go to David, it's davidrovick.com, right? R-O-V-I-C-S. There's a song called After the Revolution. If you need to feel some hope, listen to that song.
Yeah. All right, we've got some open lines at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Here's Al and Ingster. Al, hi, you're on the air.
You got to press that darn button again. He's gone.
It went away. How did that happen?
Call back, Al, from Ingster.
Right. Here is Jeff. Jeff, you're out at Ozfest?
Yeah, I'm on my way out of Ozfest right now. Traffic is crazy.
Oh, I can imagine.
We can't play any Ozzy, dude. Sorry.
Crazy Train is what we ought to be playing.
Yeah, right.
I just wanted to correct your previous caller about Bush's family fortune, where it comes from. You were correct. You're correct in stating that a lot of it comes from Nazi money. In 1951, Fritz Thiessen died. He was the industrialist that funded Hitler's war machine.
Right.
Who he's who Prescott Bush worked for at Brown Brothers Harriman business in the 20s and 30s. And the Bush family inherited $1.5 million in 1951. And Prescott Bush, that same year, hired Richard Nixon through an ad in the newspaper in California to finance Richard Nixon's political career.
Wow.
The family didn't get into oil until George moved to
Texas
after he got married. And what most people don't realize is that George Bush Sr. has been CIA since the day he left Yale.
Hmm. And he was the head of the CIA, too.
He was head of the CIA. And I always wondered, why would the CIA not promote from within? Why would this guy out of nowhere just all of a sudden become the head of the CIA? Well, it's because he's been in the CIA his entire life.
Well, thank you. You know, I actually, and I mean this very sincerely, I have great admiration for people like yourself that can kind of store all that information because...
And having been at that rock show with all that loud music, your ears and brain have to be ringing, and here you are rattling it off.
Yeah. Because
I'm an information warrior. I'm a student of Alex Jones, and I'm spreading the word to everybody that I meet, teaching them the things that the schools do not teach and the news will not report.
Well, I have all this, by the way, if one thing, you can Google this. If you put, like, Bush Nazis, for instance, you'll be incredulous what you'll come up with. But also, again, I can keep promoting my own website. If you go to Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and then down on the right side, there's Bush pages. Everything that Jeff was just telling you is there and documented. And, in fact, I don't think even anybody disagrees with it. Although I want to get some more information on this Rosemary Baby's origin of Barbara Bush.
That's very interesting.
It was Barbara
Bush was actually caught red-handed with the Firestone family, J.P. Morgan, and many others in a Nazi American coup. They tried to
right.
They hired General Smedley Butler and tried to take over the United States in 1935. And this is our president's grandfather who tried to turn America into Nazi America.
Yeah, well, not Nazi. That was actually in 1933, and it was before Hitler had actually come to power. But they were very, these industrialists here in the United States and these right-wing political figures, these corporatists, which is exactly what fascism is, were admiring Mussolini's Italy. That's what they saw as the model, not Hitler's Germany. So it was a little bit before that, but all the same, could be in George's blood.
Now, this sex thing Aleister Crowley, I think that was Bush Sr.'s mom.
Bush Sr.'s mom.
Talking about, not Barbara. Barbara. Oh. Well, I'm not going there.
All right. Well,
I'm going to keep it clean.
It? Marianne.
Doug Podell, just for you.
Marianne said to you. And maybe, here, Ron in South Lyon. You got a clue about this, Ron? You're
on
the air.
I think I do, Peter.
What's that?
Well, basically, everything that you might think is real isn't.
Well put.
Yeah.
And actually, Julene, I've talked to Peter before.
Yeah.
But if you got the night show, it's probably not a rock and roll song. I think One Tin Soldier by Coven is pretty much tells the story of Iraq. Because if you turn the stone over, there's going to be an oil well underneath it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Or Afghanistan, whatever. Because I'm the macrobiotic dude, Peter.
You're the macrobiotic guy?
Yeah. I've talked to you before, but one time I was a little pissed off. Excuse me.
You were mad at Peter?
No.
Oh.
At the way they were portraying the thing for the, you know, the soldiers to be real patriotic in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And just shoot the farmers in the fields because it's a free fire zone.
Yeah.
And make more enemies than they could possibly ever make friends.
Well, yeah, my wife has a pin that says, making enemies faster than we can kill them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's what's happening in Iraq today, to be sure. Thank you, Ron. Thanks for joining us from South Lyon. And there's some call space available if you want to join us at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Oh, here, Greg is listening in Zapata, Texas. Wow.
Wow.
Named after the great Mexican revolutionary Emiliano Zapata. He says, Peter, everybody knows Grandfather Prescott Bush was fined during World War II for trading with the enemy. It is a fact that the U.S. gave refuge to Nazi scientists and spies after World War II, to be sure, as a way to beat the Soviets in the Cold War. There is a bizarre website by a man who claims he has uncovered a web of Nazi war criminals still alive in the U.S. and that Bobby George H.W. Bush was a German spy. Oh, come on, and the son of a Nazi leader given refuge in America. But you can go to the Bush Connection. It's called the BushConnection.com. Wow. I'm just looking at it. Yeah.
Quite a disturbing picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
check it out. See for yourself. Theater of the mind's not working.
There's an old, Woody Guthrie song. Talking about Pretty Boy Floyd, the outlaw.
Oh, I've heard you talk about
that. Yeah, and one of the lines is, every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. So that's...
Throw it on there.
Yeah, so that's what's happening to the old Bush baby. All right, we're going to take a break. Again, there's open lines if you'd like to join us. 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743. We'll be right back.
WRIF.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and this is our last segment. Joining me, Jalene Jordan. And at the top of the hour, we're going to be having a couple of very interesting guests. Reese Ehrlich, who's just written a book called The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, and also Larry Burns from the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. And we'll be talking about the damage that NAFTA has done to particularly our region, but the United States in general. I had this as well. We were talking earlier about Whackmaster. Is that what
Which
is that?
One?
Ted Nugent was really gone off the edge, and so and actually, do I have to tell you that one of Ted Nugent's first songs was "Journey to the Center of the Mind"? So, Dave.
That sounds like he's on drugs.
Yeah. Dave, well, it's a total psychedelic song.
Right.
Dave in Detroit writes to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Ted Nugent has taken a journey to the center of Uranus.
I'm sorry.
I like that. He says, Kyle
it's
Rowe.
A planet.
Yeah,
it's
however,
a planet. We reiterate.
Has not left the White House yet. Although his departure has been announced, he's not set to leave until August 31st.
Right.
And thus, his absence cannot explain George Bush's nonsensical Vietnam speech. Remember,
right, I know. I knew he was still there. Okay. I was just coming up with some kind of... Yeah. It was kind of a joke.
Can we have a little section about toys?
What kind of toys?
Toys.
Toys from China?
Toys from
or
China.
Or toys from that store in San Francisco?
There's one right down the street from me.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Continuing onward. Efforts, I'm going to turn off her mic. There we go.
Go ahead, toys.
This is from the McClatchy newspapers, which is just doing incredible work. Efforts to crack down on lead paint in toys thwarted by China. We know they don't give a crap. And also the Bush administration. The Bush administration and China have both undermined efforts to tighten rules designed to ensure that lead paint isn't used in toys, bibs, jewelry, and other children's products. Both have fought efforts to better police imported toys from China. Now both are under increased scrutiny following last week's massive toy recall by Mattel. Mm-hmm. The Bush administration has hindered regulation on two fronts, consumer advocates say. It stalled efforts to press for greater inspections of imported children's product. Why would they do something like that? And it altered the focus of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, moving it from aggressive protection of consumers to a more manufacturer-friendly approach.
And not people-friendly, not kid-friendly, no. Not health-friendly.
So Bush now has become the poisoner of children as well.
Just add that to the list. We were just talking about
every
that.
Every crime in Oklahoma is added to his name.
Right.
The other toy item, a demonstration has been held in southeast Afghanistan accusing U.S. troops of insulting Islam after they distributed footballs bearing the name of Allah. I mean,
oh,
how stupid are these people?
Oh.
I just can't. I mean, they should. You draw a cartoon and they riot, man. You gotta. So here's what happened. The ball showed the Saudi Arabian flag, which is inscribed with the Quranic from the Quran, mm-hmm. a declaration of faith. The U.S. military said the idea had been to give something for Afghan children to enjoy, and they did not realize it would cause offense. The footballs were dropped from a helicopter.
No.
I mean, if people weren't getting slaughtered and our troops weren't getting killed and maimed, this would actually be funny. Some displayed flags from countries all over the world, including Saudi Arabia, which features the Shahada, one of the five pillars of Islam, the Declaration of Faith. The words which include the name of Allah are revered, and Muslims are very sensitive about where and how they can be used. An Afghan member of parliament said to have a verse of the Quran on something you kick with your foot would be winning hearts and minds. This is where our tax dollars are going, folks.
An all new low.
Yeah. All right. Here's Matt in River Rouge. Matt, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Peter?
Going good. Yeah.
Hey. I just wanted to talk about I've been listening to you guys for a few months now, and it made me go to school.
Really?
And I took a sociology class at Henry Ford, and I was just wondering if you ever talked to a teacher there named Rondell Harvell.
Ron Harvell. What's the last name again?
Harvell.
Harvell. I don't know. Sounds a little familiar. What school again? I'm sorry. I'm multitasking and not doing a good job.
Yeah, I took a class in sociology, and
I heard that part.
Beginner's class, and
yeah.
what it was about is how these institutions in America pretty much train us from kindergarten on to believe certain things and do certain things, and you know, it's just amazing. It opened up my mind, and it really makes me wonder, you know, where is America going in 2007?
I'll tell you where. Straight to hell.
Hell in a handbasket. I'm on the highway to hell.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. And, yeah.
And we're
know,
not making
I,
light of it.
I have a son of my own. He's 16 months old. And, you know, I feel sorry for our next generation. Mm. And it's just amazing how, you know, the things that I was led to believe and the real truth behind them, they don't teach you that in school.
Well, I'll tell you, Matt, what you've hit on the key phrase, and that is critical thinking, to not just accept, you know, what do they call it? I can't think of the phrase, but just, you know, what you're given uncritically. And it's hard. I mean, sometimes people have said to me, well, how do I know what to believe? They can listen to some right-wing talk show host and
think, oh, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, and then they'll listen to me and Jalene, and they'll go, yeah, then how do we figure it out? And I said, well, it's up to you. It's kind of what makes sense overall. And I guess I think that you know, the right wing is in this polemic against reality and always playing on people's emotions. When you expose them to reality, the facts of reality, their little house of cards are like the Wicked Witch of the West. They just dissolve into a puddle. Unfortunately, though, right wingers are so aggressive that they very frequently wind up in positions of power and wealth. Most of us are sort of, you know, we're into making our life as good as it can be.
You want to pay the bills, right?
And pay the bills, but they're the aggressive people, and they always wind up in control of countries. So that's why there were, you know, it turns out to be so many things like wars, for instance. That they aggressive people love wars because all their rage can find a socially justifiable place to express itself in. Right. All right, well, yeah, keep on doing it. Thank you, Matt.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
so
wonderful.
Thank you very much.
That's so wonderful you went to school after listening to this show. See, the little ripple effect we talk about, Peter.
All right.
The pebble.
Wait a minute. This is here.
Are we in trouble now?
No. Jeremy just wrote us from the other room, or Al. Just wrote that.
Jeremy over there.
Just called in to say that it was Barbara Bush's mother that had sex with the Aleister Crowley.
Okay, see, I knew it wasn't. So it's Barbara's mother. Oh, God, that's scary.
Yeah.
I mean, it was scary enough to think about Barbara.
Well, but Led Zeppelin was into Aleister Crowley as well.
Well, no, I'm not talking about the Aleister Crowley part. I'm just talking about either of them having anything to do with sex. But we know that they did because she created a monster of a family.
What a brood.
Yeah.
What a brood. Well, I wonder... but Aleister Crowley wasn't a bad guy. I mean, he was...
He was just what's
the word I'm looking for?
Eccentric.
No. He had some belief. But he had things like... Do as thou wilt, which means will, but do as thou wilt, harming no one.
Okay, that works for me.
Yeah, that's very, very good. And he's not a Satanist. Come on, you folks know that stuff. 313-298.
There's a whole song about it, for crying.
9743, there is. Yeah, one of those Zeppelin. Didn't some of the Zeppelin songs make allusion?
Ozzy Osbourne did it, Mr. Crowley.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Some of you Ozfest.
Good DJ. I'm patting myself.
Right, right. Here's Alan Inkster. Al, you're back. You're on the air, Al.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm back.
Go ahead.
You forgot some of the better lyrics from that Woody Guthrie song.
With the pretty
some
boy.
Some men rob you with a six gun, some men use a fountain pen, but you'll never see an outlaw put a family on the street when he's on the run.
Yeah. Well, that was true in the 30s. I'm not sure that that's true anymore. There was sort of a romanticization during the 1930s when Woody Guthrie wrote songs like that about some of the outlaws of the time. Now, the modern-day outlaws, they will drive a family from their home.
With a fountain pen.
There's a difference between outlaws and criminals, I guess.
Well, there's an incredible film with Donald Sutherland and
telling me about this.
Jane Fonda called Steelyard Blues.
Oh, okay.
And at one point, Donald Sutherland says, you know, I'm not a criminal, I'm an outlaw. And she says, what's the difference? He says, I don't know.
You're kind of an outlaw, Peter.
Oh, it's just my persona. I'm so conservative in my personal life, aren't
you
I?
You're not.
Yeah.
Fooling all the people.
So, what do you want to talk about? Flag desecration?
Well, flag, and then you mentioned what's his name? I'll never forget what's his name. Our long lost hunter.
Oh, Ted.
Yeah, no, and I was like, okay, now if I advocated what sounded like the violent assassination of elected officials, I'd have Secret Service agents so far up the wazoo. Okay.
But he's on the okay side. He's protected.
Thank you. Yeah, just getting back to that, people. Ted Nugent, in this appearance, essentially threatened two presidential candidates, two senators from the United States Senate,
Hillary and Barack.
Hillary and Barack Obama, and you're absolutely right. Had one of us, here's this guy, I don't know, I would like to believe these were fake machine guns that he had. You know, he had a chance during, I forgot about that too. He had a chance during the Vietnam War to actually use a machine gun, but he has explained in interviews how he scammed out of the draft. He just peed and crapped in his underwear for about a week.
What?
And then, he got posed as he was crazy. So Nugent's another one of these chicken hawks that he just, you know, bellows about guns and, you know, and shoving, what does he say, hey, Hillary, you might want to ride one of these machine guns into the sunset, you worthless bitch.
Wow.
What a sicko. And of course, I mean, this is just, what do you call it? It's filled with homophobia and misogyny and all of that. The guy is one sick puppy. You would think, I mean, one of the things that there are a few right-wing rock and rollers and there are a few right-wing artists and what have you.
Very few.
Overwhelmingly, creative people are on the left. Fascists can't make art is usually the rule, but a few of them, you know, they can. They can. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let's see. Oh, here's maybe somebody can tell us about Aleister Crowley. Jeff from Toledo. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
How you doing, guys?
Good.
Hey, Jeff.
Okay, listen. I was listening to you talk about this Aleister Crowley thing with Barbara Bush. And
lay it out.
Okay. It is actually the truth.
Okay.
That she did contact Aleister Crowley and did actually go there. But the thing is that the people who were laying out this new thing, which is now a religion, it's called Wicca.
Yeah.
And the people...
Wicca's not a bad thing.
No, absolutely not. No, it's not.
Right.
But see, Gerald Gardner and Doreen Valiente were the two that put the Wicca thing together. And Aleister Crowley was part of all of this. And
now, doesn't Wicca go back to... I mean, it's pagan.
No, it was
no one
no,
actually
no,
put
absolutely
it together,
not.
Right?
It was created by these people.
Hmm.
Post-World War II. But the thing is that Aleister Crowley was up in his years then... And he was getting kind of weird about letting anybody in.
Yeah.
And these people had money. And he thought, well, you know, this would get us established in the United States much quicker because these people have money. But fortunately, Gardner and Valiente said, wait a minute, how did these people come to you? And see, Aleister Crowley, people don't realize, he worked for MI5 during World War II.
For the British Secret Service, yeah.
Because he was connected with mystics in Germany, the OTO.
The old OTO.
During the war.
Ordo Templi Orientis.
Yes, during the war. And they were...
How do I know that? I'm reading it off the screen here.
I was going to say, you amaze me.
Yeah.
They were very concerned about how... She actually got to Aleister Crowley, and it was through word of mouth, through diplomatic services.
Did she have a sex ritual with him?
Well, that's
what I want to know.
The question is, see, it's all based on Kabbalah, which is Judeo-Christian sex magic. It's Western,
what?
Not Eastern.
Yeah.
So the thing is...
That's what, what's her name?
Madonna.
Madonna's into.
Right. And, yeah. and see, it's very powerful stuff. And the thing is that... We don't know whether they consummated anything or not. That no one is really sure whether Aleister Crowley gave her the information.
So maybe Barbara Bush is Aleister Crowley's daughter.
Protégé of some type.
Well, wait a minute. But here, So when do you think Barbara Bush was born? Was she like 70? No, she's got to be more than that. Say she's 80. Okay.
So it was pre-World War II. It had to be like 1924.
Well, that'll work because Crowley, although it says in England they call him Crowley, Aleister Crowley, we'll call him. Lived from 1875 to 1945, so 25, so yeah, 45, yeah, so he'd be like 45 in 1920 or 25 or something
right.
like that, yeah, yeah.
But he had been getting careless in his later years about who he was letting into these groups because he was trying to, they were deciding how they were going to build it and get it over into North America.
Uh-huh.
But see, the thing about the Bushes is they came to them through people through diplomatic channels, through people, you know, in Britain, like the higher, what do you call them, the prince of whoever, you know,
yeah.
over there. And they got concerned, Gardner and Valiente got concerned about that because they thought, well, this isn't just somebody who read Aleister Crowley's stuff and then said, oh, I got to go over there and, you know, see what's going on with that. It was more of a higher-ranking diplomatic people in England who, like, got her to him.
Yeah.
It just gets weirder
and weirder. All right, I'm having trouble following this, but I appreciate it. Here.
Interesting.
Here, is Aleister Crowley the father of Barbara Bush? Possibly that George Bush is related to...
I just made that up.
This is Cannon Fire. You can go to... what is it? Cannon
we
Fire.
Are so not conspiracy people.
Cannonfire.
What are we doing?
Blogspot. Cannonfire.blogspot.com. Few people will understand that one of the most notorious individuals in British history may have contributed to the lineage of our current president. Aleister Crowley, a.k.a. the Great B666, the infamous practitioner of sex magic whose motto was, do what thou wilt, came to know a great many remarkable people, including the maternal grandmother of George W. Bush. The story may seem difficult to believe. Many say it's too long. It's too long. I can't.
Okay.
And we're gonna have to. You can check it out. All you got to do is put in. Looks like Crowley. C R O W L E Y and Bush, and you'll find out all about it. But this is interesting.
Okay.
Here's Lars and Troy. Lars, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Julian. I just wanted to see if you guys have ever heard of the Battle of Athens, Tennessee.
I missed that one. Although one of my great-great-grandfathers, something, fought at the Battle of Lookout Mountain as part of the Ohio Volunteers or something.
Oh, basically,
like that.
It was in 1946. The county sheriff had basically set himself up as a dictator over a small community in outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. All the local people had sent to, you know, the higher authorities for help. They were ignored. So a group of World War II veterans actually launched an armed revolt to overthrow him. He was involved in bootlegging. He had confiscated all the election ballots, and he's going to count them in private so he could say that he won.
Is this where everybody was ordered to wear their underwear on the outside of their clothing as well?
You can look it up. There's books about it. Yeah, he even shot a black man in the back for refusing to go home after being told he couldn't vote.
What?
A Southern sheriff did that? It's hard for me to believe that. Yeah.
So a group of World War II veterans raided the National Guard Armory. They laid siege to the sheriff's department overnight. And in the morning, someone threw a stick of dynamite on the front porch, and that ended it. They gave up then. And then he was forced out of office, and the GI candidate he was trying to repress from taking his power was elected to office.
Wow,
lots
that's
of
quite
people.
A story.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Lars, thank you for that. I will check that one out as well. Here's Jimmy, in St. Clair Shores. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, longtime listener, love the show. You were talking earlier about they were dropping footballs from helicopters.
In Afghanistan.
With inscriptions from the Quran.
Right.
Well, I'm not a big sports fan, but... don't they also call footballs pigskins? And, you know, sacrilege to eat pork.
What was that last part?
That's what I thought. When I saw the headline about blasphemous balls anger Afghans, I thought, it must be PO'd because it's probably made from pigskin. But that wasn't it. With that, dear friends, we're going to have to end. But I thank you for that. I appreciate it. And unfortunately, Bill, we're going to have to do this next week. Bill is calling in from Windsor, and we just ran completely out of time. He wanted to tell us how Americans are viewed outside of America.
Oh, we'd love to hear that.
Unfortunately, got to go, so we're going to have to do that next
week.
Time.
Promise.
Next week. Oh, no, we're not going to be on next week.
2 weeks. You have to wait.
Labor Day.
Yeah.
Labor Day. So go to a Labor Day celebration. Let's bring labor back as a powerful institution in this country
again. If you're craving Peter Werby and me, Julian Jordan, you can always go and listen to some of our past shows.
Yeah.
And, you can't get it all, can't listen every time, I'm sure. So just go to WRIF.com, find our podcast, and listen away.
Or you can, we haven't said it in a long time. The show is repeated tomorrow, I think twice even, on radiopower.org.
And it's also on RIF 2, our HD radio station.
Right. And it is also archived at WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can go to my website, I'll say this for the final time, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E. .com and click on the microphone on the left side. Jolene, we'll see you in a couple weeks.
All right.
All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10 exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. WRIF.com.
Yeah.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. As we look at the news almost nightly, read the newspapers, listen to the radio, the conflict with Iran, how did it get to that point? Sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? But let's take a look at what's going on in that country, the role that Iran plays in the Middle East, and why the United States is in conflict with us. Let me dip my pronoun there, not us, with the United States government of George W. Bush. Joining me is Reese Ehrlich, and Reese Ehrlich is the author of an about-to-be-published book called The Iran Agenda, the real story of U.S. policy in the Middle East crisis, something that we want to get into here. He's co-authored Target Iraq. Reese Ehrlich produced the 2001 radio documentary, The Struggle for Iran, narrated by Walter Cronkite and broadcast on NPR. And he writes regularly for Mother Jones, the San Francisco Chronicle, Dallas Morning News, St. Petersburg Times, lots of other places as well. If we spend too much time on how much work Reese Ehrlich has done in journalism, we won't have time to interview him. Joining us from Oakland, California, Reese Ehrlich, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you very much, Peter.
And congratulations on this new book, The Iran Agenda, the real story of U.S. policy and the Middle East crisis.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've been to both Iran and Iraq several times. How does one go there? Could I just get on a plane at Detroit Metro and head over there?
Well, one of my favorite airports, of course, is Detroit Metro. If you're going to Iran, it's actually very difficult right now, either as a tourist or as a reporter, if you're holding a U.S. passport. For some reason, are very suspicious of American reporters and think they don't do a very good job, and they put you through a lot of grief before letting you over there. And every single trip I've made to Iran, and a couple that I didn't, then you go through the same visa hassles. But once you do get your visa, you can fly. Actually, U.S. has no direct connections or any connections with Iran in terms of airlines. But you can fly in from Germany, from Britain, from France. All the major European countries have either daily flights or every other daily flights into Tehran and similar places. In terms of Iraq, of course, it's very dangerous to go into Baghdad. Mm-hmm. But what I did is I flew from Tehran to Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. It's in the Kurdish-controlled area. And there's actually every other day flights, the best, the cheapest, and the most regular flights from Iran to both the two major cities in Iraqi Kurdistan. And in case your listeners aren't already familiar with it, soon the U.S. will be complaining about the Iranian influence in Kurdistan because they've actually got very close ties with those strong U.S. allies, the Kurds.
And Iran has very strong ties with the government that just today that George W. Bush said, no, I do support the Maliki government. I do. It only sounded like I was being critical.
Yeah, he's kind of stuck, though, isn't he?
So Iran is supposed to be the big enemy of all the countries of the Middle East and of the United States, yet it seems to have relationships with the major countries to the point where President Ahmadinejad may make a state visit to Baghdad. It all sounds pretty crazy.
Yeah, you've had the major foreign minister advisors and big state visits between Iraq and Iran. Al-Maliki has gone to Iran a number of times. Yeah, for background, you have to remember that during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, which was a horrific conflict, where Saddam Hussein invaded and occupied parts of Iran with full U.S. backing, by the way, because Saddam Hussein was our ally.
Mm-hmm.
The good guy who was gassing his own people, all backed by the United States at that time. But the Iranians cultivated ties with dissident groups in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and particularly with Shia groups, but also with the Kurds. And so all the Kurdish leaders had lived in Tehran at one time or another. All of the major political party leaders, almost all of them, now in power in Iraq, lived in Iran at one time or another. So these ties go back 15, 20 years, and the U.S. comes in just in the last couple of years and says, hey, what's going on here? How come Iran has so much influence? So yes, the Iran, the way the Iraqis look at it is sooner or later the U.S. is getting out, but Iran ain't moving. you know, it's our going to be our next door neighbor, and we better figure out how to have relations with them.
And is Iran the big dog in the Middle East? There's Israel, of course.
Well, Israel's the big dog. Yeah. Israel's the 800-pound gorilla and the big dog all combined into one. But, it, you know, is Iran sees itself as a emerging regional power, let's say, and they want to be treated as such. The U.S. of course helped establish that for them by overthrowing the two governments who were most opposed to Iran, that is Saddam Hussein's government and the Taliban in Afghanistan, who had horrific relationships with Iran.
Go over that again. I want you to say that very clearly.
Yeah. Most people kind of lump together Islamic fundamentalists and Taliban and Iran. They must all be in cahoots. Oh, help us! As the threat of terrorism. In point of fact, the Taliban, who were Sunni fundamentalists, were 110% opposed to the Shia fundamentalists in power in Iran. In the 1990s, the Taliban murdered 11 Iranian diplomats in a famous incident that almost brought those two countries to war against each other. Again, not much publicized here because it doesn't fit the typical stereotype or scenario that the Bush administration wants to push. But they were deadly enemies. The Iranians supported the Northern Alliance, the same people that ultimately the U.S. supported and brought to power in Afghanistan. And the Iranians were overjoyed at the overthrow of the Taliban.
And of Saddam Hussein as well.
And of Saddam Hussein as well,
yeah.
Of course.
Reese Ehrlich is my guest. He is the author of the forthcoming The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis. And most people don't realize that history is longer ago than 2 weeks. So we have to go back about 50 years to really get to the bottom of the story. And I think some people do know this, but maybe a shorthand history of why this enmity between the United States and Iran and,
sure.
and its origins. Yeah.
Sure. Well, you know, it's ironic that the U.S. talks about wanting to bring democracy to the Middle East, and that's one of the major reasons that we went into Iraq, and we'd like to have democracy in Iran. And, well, you know, Iran had a democracy. In 1952-53, it had one of the most democratic governments, certainly in the Middle East, and arguably in the entire Third World.
And secular.
Yeah. Led by a nationalist by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh. He was duly elected by Parliament. He was scrupulous about allowing free press and civil institutions, political parties free to organize, all the things of civil society that the U.S. claims it wants for various countries around the world. Well, he also, with full vote of Parliament, voted to nationalize the British oil company that was then had the monopoly on oil exploration and transportation in Iran. And, of course, the British didn't like that, and the U.S. didn't like that. So the CIA conspired with the British and with the Shah, the king of Iran, to overthrow the democratic government of Iran, eliminate free press, eliminate parliament for all intents and purposes, eliminate political parties, eliminate the civil society institutions, and impose a ruthless dictatorship for the next 20-odd years, 20-plus years, actually. And that was directly led to the Islamic Revolution of 1979, with Ayatollah Khomeini coming to power and all that we see today.
So
the U.S. is directly responsible for what happened in Iran as a result of its policies of wiping out the secular democratic government that Iran did have.
So
the Iranians, you can't, you know, fault the Iranians for laughing rather loudly when they hear the U.S. proclaiming that it supports and wants democracy.
Mm-hmm. And this was bipartisan support of the Shah and this horrid dictatorship. Didn't Jimmy Carter famously have New Year's dinner with the Shah, in 1979, I think it was? Or
absolutely.
Something?
No. There were differences about the coup. Truman opposed the coup as it was planned by the CIA, and the minute Eisenhower came into power, they went straight ahead with the coup, and it occurred. But once that was over, once the Shah was in power, he was a staunch U.S. ally. Johnson and Kennedy loved the Shah. The Republicans loved the Shah. Exactly. The Jimmy Carter allowing the Shah to come to the U.S. for medical treatment was the incident that then sparked the hostage taking at the U.S. Embassy in Iran and so on. So, yes, the U.S. policy towards Iran in support of the Shah was bipartisan, much as is today's U.S. policy towards Iran. You know, you listen to Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or John Edwards, not to mention other Democratic leaders, and they really don't sound all that different about aggression towards Iran than does the Bush administration. Where they differ in some cases is about whether to immediately bomb Iran. But otherwise, they pretty much share the same objectives and goals.
Mm-hmm. Now, I forgot about the medical care for the Shah. That the hostages were taken, the demand was to return the Shah to their country for trial for all the crimes he'd committed.
That's right.
Yeah.
Much like a certain Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the other hand, we, and I tell me if we is correct here, I'm sure neither of us want to whitewash the Iranian government and this theocracy that certainly does not meet the norms that of the government that was overthrown 50 years ago mm-hmm. or so. And tell us a little about the structure of the government. People have said, like, for instance, we always, every wild statement that President Ahmadinejad makes is trumpeted, yet some people say he doesn't even have that much power.
Yeah, the nature of the government in power in Iran is very complicated because it's neither a typical kind of third world military dictatorship or dictatorship of the kind, say, that the U.S. backs in Saudi Arabia or various other parts of the Middle East. They do have elections. The elections are competitive. They're not fair or free or democratic because people are prohibited from running if you don't adhere to the rather narrow guidelines of the government. But once you get nominated and accepted, it's a genuine competitive elections. They have a parliament. They have different newspapers and so on. But basically, I call it clerical capitalism. You have a group of clerics and revolutionary guards and military and intelligence who really run the country. The president doesn't have that much power. The power resides with someone called the supreme leader. It used to be Ayatollah Khomeini. Now it's Khamenei, you don't have to go back too far. Just a couple years ago when the reformist president was in power, Khatami, and it was obvious that he didn't have that much power because everything he started saying would get countermanded by the military and intelligence and so on, and by the clerics. And that's also true with Ahmadinejad. He does not actually constitutionally or in real life have that much power. He's just a lightning rod because of all these doofus comments he makes with regularity that just plays directly into the hands of every neocon and doofus here in the United States. He is increasingly unpopular in Iran, and I agree with you. The Iranian government is a reactionary government that oppresses its own people, and the people of Iran are not real happy with it and would love to get rid of it. That, however, does not give the U.S. the excuse to bomb Iran or carry out terrorist raids inside Iran, which is what they're doing now, under the guise of wanting to promote democracy.
Whoa. Back up on that one. Tell us some about that.
Yeah, about the terrorist attack?
Yeah.
Yeah, again, this has occurred. It has appeared in the media, but very little and no follow-up. ABC Television News had a very good one-time feature that showed the CIA is paying Iranian Americans to then, in turn, pay terrorists in Balochistan, which is an area of Iran that borders Pakistan, to carry out terrorist raids, blowing up busts of Revolutionary Guards and killing numerous civilians that happen to be in the area. The same thing has gone on in Khuzestan, which is the area near Iraq. It's the Arab minority that lives in Iran. And I found out directly the U.S. is also doing that in Kurdistan. There's a Kurdish area that is next to northern Iraq, and the U.S. is doing the same thing there. So, and this is, again, I think, with bipartisan support, it's okay for the U.S. to sponsor terrorist attacks, and I'm not using that term lightly. When you go in, you intentionally kill civilians for the purposes of disrupting the government, and that's what the U.S. is doing. They're, of course, not owning up to it, but there have been too many on-the-record examples, even in U.S. media, not to mention internationally, to show that that's actually true.
Yeah. Now, Reese Erlich, one of the complaints of the United States government, the Bush government, against Iran is that, and they use this phrase frequently, that Iran is meddling in Iraq.
Unlike the United States.
I've used the example that if China was fighting a war against Canada and Mexico and had a couple hundred thousand troops total in those two countries on each side of us, the way the United States is fighting in Iraq on the, what is it, the west and Afghanistan on the east, we'd be more than a little disturbed.
Yeah, and then what right would we have to meddle in China's war, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is the kettle calling the pot black or whatever it is, or the other way around. The Iranians, as we talked about before, have historically in the last 20, 25 years had influence in Iraq, and they've cultivated that influence precisely with the people who are now running the country. They are not the source of the insurgency. Their arms are not so significant that the insurgency, therefore, would somehow be affected if the Iranians stopped. It's the classic outside agitators argument. Oh, my God, we're losing in Iraq not because of anything we're doing and not because the people of Iraq are ticked off at us. We're losing because of these outside agitators, the Al-Qaeda on the one hand and the Iranians on the other. If Iran disappeared tomorrow, and the current government disappeared and all arms shipments or political support, whatever, ended tomorrow, the U.S., it would make absolutely no difference for the U.S. in fighting the insurgency in Iraq. It's a homegrown insurgency that's perfectly capable of, well, buying U.S. weapons or just simply taking them off the back of the truck, as we now know that happened, where there's, what, several hundred thousand U.S. weapons missing that are showing up all over the place in the hands of insurgents.
My guest on the Peter Werby Show is author and journalist Reese Ehrlich. His forthcoming book is The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis. It's going to be published by Polypoint Press. You can go to p3books.com. A description of it should be up there very soon. Well, a couple more questions, I think, which are on everyone's mind, is that that Iran says it has the right to develop nuclear power in the manner that any number of other countries do. I don't think any country should have nuclear anything, but the United States, of course, and the European Union say this has the potential for nuclear weapons. Let me ask you, what's the answer to that? Are they? Is it knowable?
Well, okay. The short answer is they do not have nuclear weapons, and it's impossible to know somebody's intent, and the U.S. has certainly never proved that the Iranians have, in fact, developed nuclear weapons, and you need go no further than the international agency, IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which was 100% on the money when it came to nuclear weapons in Iraq. And they have never said that Iran has nuclear weapons or plans to develop nuclear weapons.
Well, wait, but there's a difference. Nobody says they have them.
IAEA says they have no indication that Iran is planning to develop nuclear weapons, although there's particular things that give them concern. They want to see more inspections, et cetera, et cetera. But they have never said, and I've read the record very carefully, the IAEA has never said that Iran is planning to build nuclear weapons. The problem is, I mean, the irony here, of course, is that in the 1960s and 70s, the U.S. almost insisted that Iran develop nuclear power, because the U.S. wanted to sell them nuclear power reactors. Westinghouse and GE and others were set to build upwards of 11 nuclear power plants between the U.S. and Europeans. So the idea that Iran doesn't need nuclear power because it's got so much oil and gas is just hooey. They just want the U.S. to sell them the nuclear power and to have a pro-U.S. Dictator in power, then it's okay. But, look, do we need to trust the Iranians? No, we do not. I don't want to see Iran have nuclear bombs. I don't want to see Israel have nuclear bombs. The whole Middle East should be a nuclear-free zone. I don't want to see Pakistan and India having nuclear weapons, although we seem to be cozying up to them just fine. The way you make sure that Iran doesn't develop nuclear weapons is by having regular and verifiable inspections by the agency that really knows what it's doing, that's not being guided by political desire to overthrow the government, but actually looks at the issues. And the IAEA is perfectly capable of inspecting the Iranian power generating facilities and so on to make sure it's not being diverted to something else.
Now, it would make grotesque, certainly, but grotesque geopolitical sense for Iran to develop nuclear weapons, because they can see from their neighbor Iraq, and the North Korean experience is, if you don't have weapons of mass destruction, you get invaded by the United States. If you do have them and you threaten the United States, remember, North Korea said that they would drown the United States in a lake of fire. And we said, well, let's come on to the table. Let's cut a deal here. So it would certainly, within the context of U.S. coming 6,000 miles from our homeland to fight a war on its borders, and for Israel to have nuclear weapons, it certainly would make, as I said, grotesque political sense for Iran, in fact, to develop them.
Well, that's true. I mean, if you're sitting and running the government of Iran and you say, what can we do to deter a possible U.S. attack? Having a nuclear weapon would certainly be one thing, although, you know, you're having one or two nuclear bombs and no way to deliver it to the United States is not exactly much of a deterrent.
No.
Probably more on their mind is having a strong conventional and anti-invasion set of tactics ready.
Which they have.
Right. I think that's a much stronger deterrent. Even though I've interviewed all kinds of people throughout Washington and read very carefully all the neocon statements, none of them are calling for an invasion, an occupation of Iran, as we did in Iraq. And there's a reason for that, because they know the U.S. You think the U.S. has problems in Iraq, the Iran is twice, three times the size, and even angrier, and the U.S. Would lose for sure.
And Iran has an intact, well-coordinated, well-equipped army. Yeah. Saddam's army by 2003 was an army of dust.
Iran would not do very well in a matchup, a conventional war against the United States. But that's not what would happen. You'd have a guerrilla war, and that the U.S. could not win. Similarly, if the U.S. does bomb Iran right now, it's going to cause all kinds of serious problems throughout the region. Iran has its allies in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Palestine, and they're all going to suddenly start attacking the U.S. forces and the U.S. allies. It's going to be an even worse mess, and it's so bad that even Washington realizes it, and that's why there's such a sharp debate within the Bush administration whether to use the overt military attacks.
Well, and anybody sensible does not want a mess, either in their house or certainly not in international affairs when military matters are under consideration. However, some people have made the point that a U.S. strike against Iran, which would erupt, and who knows, strikes back against the United States all across the world, perhaps even inside of the United mm-hmm. States,
yeah.
would actually play well into the neocon agenda. So that's what the conspiracies.
Well,
and there are conspiracies out
oh,
there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there are. No, there. I'll tell you what the neocon, or at least a number of leading proponents of the neocons are saying right now. What they're saying is, okay, the regime in Iran is on its last legs. They're about to topple. All they need is a little push from the U.S. They're particularly weak in the minority areas. That's why you see these U.S.-sponsored terrorist attacks going on almost exclusively in the minority areas. So if the U.S. bombs the Natanz facility, they bomb the headquarters of the Revolutionary Guard, the people of Iran will rise up and overthrow the government. That's the neocon. Now, does this fantasy sound familiar to anyone listening?
Yeah, let me see.
What other country did they say the same thing?
You got to remember back 4 years, not 2 weeks, though, right?
So then they say, yeah, Iran might try this stuff, but they won't be around that long because they'll have been overthrown by the angry Iranian people. Actually, in point of fact, it'll have the opposite effect. It'll rally people around the government.
Sure, but the point of this is, in a sense, the opposite, is that an attack, a further attack on U.S. assets here or abroad would strengthen the hand of the imperial presidency here in the United States, that it would actually work to the benefit of the Bush regime.
Well, I suppose I don't know. I've never met anybody who makes that argument, but I suppose there's a horrific logic to it. Doesn't matter.
You're not on all the blogs.
Abroad or how many Americans die, as long as Bush can run for third term.
Yeah.
I've never run into anybody who advocated that.
Well, I was saying, you're not reading all the blogs. So.
Oh, okay.
Well, listen, we are out of time. I should tell people that when I was substituting on a nationally syndicated show the other day, Reese Ehrlich was my guest there, and he was unceremoniously cut off by the iron fist of going to spots. But now we are the more gentle ending. We are out of time, and that time I think we had about 11 minutes. Now we've spent 25, and we've barely scratched the surface. There's a lot more from Reese Ehrlich. His book, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, should be, at this period, required reading for people. Don't, you know, when you start seeing the guys with suits and uniforms on TV and charts, you know that it's starting. So be forearmed with this book. Reese Ehrlich, as usual, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you very much, Peter.
There. The pictures, the podcast, the vlogs,
the special features you just had there.
Anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I salute yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks. 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I'm recording this today, we're at the tail end of a meeting between the presidents of the North American countries, including Mexico. You did know that was a North American country, right? Canada and the United States. And that's Presidents Calderon and Bush and Prime Minister Stephen Harper of Canada. And there's a lot of concern both on the left and the right. And though I think that for our purposes today, although I think we'll touch on that meeting, what we want to talk about with our guest is the North American Free Trade Agreement and how it's affected the United States, and particularly our area here. When I want to know stuff about Latin America and North America and issues like this, I go to Larry Burns. Larry Burns is the founder and director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Their website is COHA, COHA.org. Joining me from his Washington, D.C. office is Larry Burns. Larry, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, God, the Peter Werby Show is, that's where one wants to be.
Well, here you are. Hey, you know, I don't think there's too many people in Michigan that think NAFTA has been real great for our state and for the United States, but it's like I always tell people, I thought it was bad when I read the COHA piece, The Tail End of Free Trade, a preliminary evaluation of the impact of NAFTA on the manufacturing sector. I said, whoa, I didn't think it was this bad. Going into it, did you, and I know this was written by a colleague of yours, but I'm sure you had your hand in it and oversaw it. Did you think it was going to turn out to be this economically disastrous for the manufacturing sector?
Well, of course, I knew that we were in trouble with NAFTA in 1994 when the agreement was being signed and was going into effect, when I happened to be pulling into National Airport at that moment, that day, and I noticed a huge number of corporate jets on the ground. And in fact, I was told by an official at the airport, at the Washington airport, that there were more private airplanes parked at National Airport at that moment than ever before in its history. And all of those corporations, all of those multinational heads were there to celebrate an enormous victory for corporate America. What this did is it gave them the right to sell to a larger market abroad and pay much less wages at home. And that kind of situation is such an optimum situation if you're a corporation CEO that I knew that NAFTA would be bad for everyone else. And in fact, there's been a huge net loss of jobs in the United States, particularly manufacturing jobs. And that structure, which used to be the old middle class, people getting a job in the automobile industries, working for Maytag, or doing construction, but those jobs which paid a decent wage, which enabled you to buy a house, those jobs really rapidly, to a significant extent, disappeared. Meanwhile, of course, the corporate farms in the United States were having it very good because their crops, like corn, were being subsidized by the U.S. Congress, which enabled them to sell corn to Mexico beneath the price that a Mexican subsistence farmer could sell corn. What this meant was that in like 1 year almost, about a million Mexican farmers who had to either sell their land or had to leave their land came to the United States illegally.
Sure, those are the most ambitious of them came here. The qualities we admire in people, these are industrious farmers. They were ruined by the penetration of American corn entering the Mexican market, and they said, well, I'm not going to just go live in the slums of Mexico City or wherever else. I'm going to go to where the jobs are, right?
Yeah, of course. And by the husbands going, it produced a great deal of social shock in the families. The children, you know, didn't have a father around, and very often families would break up over this. It was the social costs of NAFTA have never been adequately assessed. We do know that one prong of NAFTA, which were the maquiladora industries, these industries along the U.S.-Mexican border, which had very poor labor conditions and environmental standards, these jobs were so awful that even in a job deficit area like Mexico, there was over a 50% turnover annually in these jobs. And now, of course, with many of these jobs migrating to China, which is lower yet in terms of its what it pays for jobs, we have seen there's been a 20 or 30% loss of Maquiladora jobs in the past couple of years.
Well, Larry Burns, let's back up just a little bit. I think some people, when they hear NAFTA, a lot of people aren't even sure what it stands for, and they just know it's something bad and something that isn't working well for Michigan and for the United States. But you would think, on the face of it, free trade, isn't that good? You get rid of all the tariffs, that all the national barriers, the world is a village, all of that. What's in it that is that has worked out so badly for Americans?
Well, the North American Free Trade Agreement was really the brainchild of one of the most outrageous Mexican political figures who ever lived, and that's Carlos Salinas, who was president of Mexico in the early 1990s. And he's famous for the speech that he gave to the World Affairs Council in San Francisco, where he warned those august figures that either you bring NAFTA to Mexico, or Mexico will send its workers to San Francisco. And then we also noticed that President Fox, who was the last president before Calderon, the present president, President Fox consistently in his campaign in Mexico, he said that he's going to create a million new jobs a year. Of course, what he didn't tell the Mexican people were that these million jobs would be created in the United States, and that Mexico didn't even create 200,000 jobs a year. And that was the momentum behind the mass migration to the United States, was that the Mexican government, a series of governments, simply failed at job creation. And what that meant was that the entire salary schedule in the United States was threatened, because the immigrants would come up here. They were illegal for the most part. That means that they were very vulnerable. They didn't belong to unions, and they didn't have the force of the law behind them. So they worked at the least possible wage, thus dragging down the entire wage structure that existed in the United States. Meanwhile, back in Mexico, the only companies that survived there, in terms of their manufacturing sector, and they had a very large manufacturing section, were those companies that were extremely large, that basically either bought out or merged with their American counterparts, while in 1 year there were over 100,000 bankruptcies in the Mexican manufacturing section, because they couldn't compete with American imports. So in a sense, price valuations were the most important aspect of this agreement, rather than improving the conditions of workers and producing a harmonious society.
But now, illegal immigration has not affected the automobile industry. The jobs that have left, the whole deindustrialization of the United States.
Yes, well, of course, the automobile sector was able to strike a special deal. I don't know how long that deal is going to survive, because both Canada and Mexico are major locations for U.S. automobile manufacturers. And the present deal that the United States, that the automobile companies had entered into with management, with the trade union, the U.S. trade union, has that each year the contract is renewed. It is weaker. The medical benefits are less, and a guaranteed number of days of work are less. It's just it's a declining status quo.
Now, any idea Larry Burns, why Bill Clinton would have signed this bill that was primarily the work of Republicans, I believe, as I remember from when the law, the NAFTA law was passed, the majority of Democrats voted against it. It was a few Democrats and all the Republicans. Why would Bill Clinton sign?
Well, that's one of the great ironies here, because we had Hillary Clinton in recent candidate appearances has basically said that NAFTA has been bad for the American worker, and she came out with some very strong demurs about what that agreement is doing. Bill Clinton, along with Salinas, was the author of NAFTA, and he was an extremely trade-oriented, and you're quite right, this was not Democratic Party legislation, but Republican Party legislation. In fact, the majority of Democrats, you remember this was the Gephardt's prime initiative, was fighting NAFTA. And the majority of Democrats voted against NAFTA, and NAFTA never would have passed if it hadn't been for the Republicans. And the administration, this was the era of Mickey Cantor, who was the special trade representative of the United States, and they sort of ruthlessly moved forward in sort of promulgating NAFTA to the nation. And it was the Clinton spoke tirelessly on the subject of this is a win-win situation. Well, of course, that turned out to be a great hoax. And Clinton is being attacked in public forums for this. In fact, just the other day, he was accused of selling out America with NAFTA. Now, I wouldn't use the phrase selling out. What I would say that he deceived America into believing that this was a win-win arrangement rather than a win-lose arrangement, that there will be both winners and losers, and that the wealthy business sectors would be, for the most part, be the winners.
I was going to say, let me guess. The wealthy people of all the three countries involved were the winners, and the workers and the poor of the three countries were the losers.
Canadians, as a matter of fact, lost 250,000 jobs, manufacturing jobs, as soon as NAFTA went into effect, because these Canadian factories became snowbirds. They went down to Mexico. Of course, the irony is they're leaving Mexico now and going to China.
Yeah, well, let's do this. In fact, let me reintroduce you. My guest in the Peter Werby Show is Larry Burns. He's the founder and director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. That's COHA.org, COHA.org. There'll be a link on my site, Peter Werby. .com as well. There's just been a meeting with President Calderon Bush and Prime Minister Harper near Montreal over the last few days, and there were demonstrations there, predictably, and by the left, concerns about trade, about NAFTA, about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and what have you. But a surprise entry into the criticism of the meeting of the three presidents was the right wing, who are fearful that this is an initial meeting to set up a North American Union that would have a single currency and merge the three countries, allowing the U.S. to lose its sovereignty entirely, which I think it's a bunch of hooey. What? Not the idea, but
I thought you were going to say. I thought it sounds very exciting to me.
No. I don't think the idea is a lot of hooey. I mean, I do, but I think that that's not what they're doing. Or am I wrong? Is there a national, a North American Union in the offing?
Well, remember that a key component of this meeting was the creation of a competitive council. And it was made up of 10, basically, business leaders from each of the three countries, the three meeting countries, Mexico, U.S., and Canada. Now, there was no input from other sectors of the economy, simply the business sector.
Sure.
And the legislation, or the expansion of NAFTA, like NAFTA New, NAFTA Heavy, would be that this would increase trade, and it would reduce the cost of competition, which means that you would be selling your goods for less to be competitive with China. And that, of course, would mean that also national control over one's resources, like the Canadians would be forced to sell their water, even though the Canadians are very reluctant to sell their water.
Like to Arizona. So the boundary waters, which they could veto any draining off of, say, Lake Michigan to pipe it down to Arizona, they would not be able to do that.
That's right. Also, there's the origin factor. In fact, many of these goods that are being produced would not have to have their place of origination listed. So you wouldn't know, for example, this morning's news about beef jerky that I happened to have bought at Walmart the other day and fed my dog. That literally did that, and my precious Jack Russell's all name, Peter Werby. That beef jerky contained some chemicals in it which were injurious to dogs, and Walmart announced that it was having this problem. This type of internationalization in one way is attractive, and in another way it's very unattractive. It's unattractive because it would be aimed at achieving price competition at all costs, and it's as if there was a monofactorial quality to life. The reason why you exist was to trade and to sell and buy at the lowest price. Well, you know, there are other factors in life as well. These agreements tend to denationalize authority and give authority to faceless entities like the World Trade Organization, the WTO, or the NAFTA dispute panel, which contain businessmen usually as the only members of these boards. And so they are projecting a society not like we've had in the past, but a new society where the monarch would be sort of the king of General Motors or his Japanese equivalent, and this would take place with extra constitutionally. You would not even have to be a constitutional amendment for this to occur.
Well, let me say that at first, as you were answering, I was thinking everything you were saying, as usual, Larry Burns, is extraordinarily interesting. But I was thinking there was somebody was going to say, wait a minute, you know, he never answered the question about is there going to be a North American Union. But the more you spoke, the more I realized that you were. And essentially you're saying they don't have to set up a formal entity, a formal political entity that drops the national borders and calls itself the North American Union. That's going to happen in a deep facto economic manner.
Let me give you an example which is hot in Washington for the past several years, and that in Canada, and that is the Canadians have a content regulation, which is that they want to preserve the Canadian culture, and with most Canadians living within 50 miles of the U.S. border, they have a real problem of being inundated by U.S. TV and magazines and so forth.
And radio programs.
And radio.
Hi, except, Canadian friends. Go ahead.
Except yours, which is Canada-friendly.
Yes.
But what we have here is that a Canadian magazine like Maclean's will not be able to successfully compete with Time Magazine or Newsweek, the Canadian editions of those magazines, because the U.S. products are much more glossy and professional and so forth. But the Maclean's basically talks about Canada, while the U.S. imports talk 5% about Canada and the rest about sort of an international culture and so forth. But so the Canadians lost an appeal on this. They were not, because it was looked upon as a restraint of trade. And so now corporations can go to the WTO or in certain instances federal court and have it established that what the United States government has done to preserve fish stock or environmental issues was a restraint of trade and would have to give way to the petitioner's claims. And I don't think that's good for a society. Basically, basically a nation is rapidly losing its ability to make vital decisions which affect its own destiny. I don't think this is a conspiracy. I simply think that this is a convenience for business interests in this country to get rid of obstacles to maximizing profits.
Larry Burns, let's do this in just in the 3 minutes we have remaining, although we could probably spend about 3.5 hours. And that's Venezuela, what's happening there. I just noticed in the New York Times today, the day we're recording, that the Times editorial page was critical of Hugo Chavez with these new, what they called reforms, where he would almost be president for life.
You know something? I think this is a complex issue, but let me remind you that President Roosevelt was president for life until he died.
Yeah, you're right.
And that is, President Chavez, that is, first of all, to get this constitutional reform passed, it has now basically gone through the legislature, which he owns, but there'll have to be a referendum. And every referendum that has been held so far, Chavez has handily won, and they've all been validated as being scrupulously fair. So if you put it another way, if you simply say that that if he's elected, if he's reelected, and if he's able to initially pass a referendum which will enable him to repeatedly run without term limits, he'd be simply like many other leaders in the world, in which there are no time limits, no term limits, they're allowed to run. The factor that everyone's leaving out in this whole discussion is that there are elections that are involved here. And now, I don't find it particularly attractive that a person be president for 35 years, and I think that Chavez is making a mistake. But unfortunately, when Chavez does these things, it takes our eye off of an important factor, that Chavez is easily the most innovative, dynamic thinker, certainly in Latin America today, and he does have personal objectionable characteristics, certainly some of them, but no one can establish the case that he's a dictator, that he has acted extra-constitutionally. In fact, this is what is so maddening to the State Department, that everything he has done in a strictly constitutional, lawful manner, according to Venezuelan law.
And what's always struck me, having been in Caracas, that it probably has the most virulent anti-government media of any country in the entire world.
It's extraordinary how anti-government that is. And it's extraordinary how the freedom of expression. You go to downtown Caracas, and there'll be fiery debates going on. There is no such thing. I mean, that is, Chavez's enemies attempt to project the situation that what we have here is a kind of more northern version of Pinochet of Chile or Stroessner of Paraguay, one of these pug-ugly dictators. But Chavez is nothing like that at all. He's a loudmouth, confrontational person, but he has apparently a genuine sense of the horror of poverty, and in the past, the wealth of Venezuela went to a very narrow band of political elites, the oil wealth, and the poor never saw any of it, just as they never saw a doctor in their lifetimes until Chavez came in and worked out the deal with Cuba, the Doctors for Oil deal. So, I think that we've got to try to maintain a sense of probity in this debate over Chavez. We have mentioned his shortcomings, but also emphasize the fact that he has a sterling record as a democratic personality operating within a constitutional society.
Larry Burns, thank you so much for joining me. Larry Burns is the founder and director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. You can go to their website directly, COHA.org, for an amazing array of commentary about events in Latin America and analyses as well. You can also link to that site by going to my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Larry Burns, as usual, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, sir.
Firestone and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.